The $3.6 billion that Bank of America, in essence, gave to the Merrill Lynch employees in bonuses, he says he doesn't know where it went or who gave the authority. So now when they go to the Merrill Lynch CEO, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, John Thain, he says the same thing. Oh, it wasn't me. It wasn't me. No. Bank of America gave the bonus. And then Bank of America says it wasn't us. Merrill Lynch gave the bonus. So nobody had any authority, but somehow $3.6 billion flew out of the door. The interests of these executives are not the interest of the banks. They don't really give a damn if Merrill Lynch exists.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting March 9th.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
And this week in Radical History from March 9th, 1865, showing that the U.S. is just fine with multitasking, U.S. military forces land at Veracruz, Mexico, and Panama, all to protect American interest simultaneously. Also on March 9th, 1879, anarchist Carlos Trotsky lives. Unlike some of the more famous anarchists of their times like Berkman and Goldman, Trotsky was early about being leery of the communist Bolshevik takeover of Russia and fought hard against the fascist rise in Italy, until forced to leave for America. Italy would put pressure on the U.S. to deport Trotsky back, and though the FBI would gather over 1,300 pages of information on Trotsky, he is able to stay ahead of the game until gunned down most likely by a mafia person in 1943. Also on this date in 1892, Ida B. Wells, friend and neighbor Tom Most, is lynched, which would prompt her anti-lynching campaign, which is followed by the destruction of a printing press and her move from Memphis to New York. In response to the alarming increase of lynching of African Americans, she compiled and published in 1895 a statistical study of lynching called A Red Record. Wells Barnett was also an integral part of the early civil rights movement, participating as secretary of the National Afro-American Council that led to the formation of the NAACP. Ida B. Wells.
And on this day in 1945, a fleet of specially modified U.S. bomber planes embarked on a mission to firebomb civilian targets in Tokyo, Japan. The actual bombing began the following day as more than 2,000 tons of incendiary explosives were dropped on houses, shops, and buildings, killing between 80 and 130,000 non-combatant Japanese civilians in the largest firestorm ever recorded. The firebombing of Tokyo was a decisive factor in forcing the Japanese surrender, which was already imminent when the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on the civilian centers of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Historians argue today over whether either act was justified, but many Japanese and Americans alike regard both bombings as crimes against humanity for which the U.S. has never atoned. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 9th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lastly, from March 9th, 1969, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which featured controversial music acts such as The Beatles, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, The Doors, and blacklisted Pete Seeger, is canceled by CBS Television. This is in the wake of the controversy over the on-air censorship of guest star Joan Baez. CBS Television canceled the show after they let Joan Baez dedicate a song to her husband David, who was convicted of draft resistance against the Vietnam War. Week in Radical History for March 10th.
The Russian Revolution began on this day in 1917, or at least the seminal events that led to the overthrowing of the Russian monarch or czar, when women workers in textile factories in Petrograd walked off their jobs and marched in the streets demanding bread and provisions, which were in short supply on account of the Russian participation in World War I. Socialists, including the Bolshevik Party of one Vladimir Lenin, urged the broadening of the marchers' demands to include an end to the war and the replacement of the monarchy with a democratically elected form of government. Tsar Nicholas responded by ordering his generals to suppress the marches with violence. The marchers, in turn, became more determined and succeeded in ousting the Tsar, whereupon a provisional government was established that represented the Russian aristocracy. And on this day in 1970, the trial of 30 U.S. soldiers responsible for the My Lai massacre during the Vietnam War commenced. The massacre, in which an Army battalion systematically raped, butchered, and burned between 300 and 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians under orders from Lieutenant Calley. Of the defendants, only Calley was convicted, himself of killing 22 civilians, a crime for which he served a total of 3 years in prison. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, March 10th.
This week in radical history, from March 11th, 1833, U.S. invades Nicaragua to protect blank interests. Anyone? Anyone?
Bueller? Bueller? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller?
On this day, March 11th, in 1917, the British Army conquered the Mesopotamian capital city of Baghdad from the Turks, dealing a decisive blow to the Ottoman Empire. The Turks had ruled over the region with some degree of brutality, and although the British general, Sir Frederick Stanley Maude, who commanded the British troops there, proclaimed on this day that the British had arrived, quote, not as conquerors, but as liberators, unquote, the preceding period of British colonial rule was even bloodier. Within a few years, several nationalist revolts were suppressed and tens of thousands of citizens were killed. The British even used poison gas against entire villages during that period. In 2001, a group of leaders of the Zapatista Rebellion in southern Mexico arrived at the Zocalo, or Central Square, in Mexico City amid the triumphal cheers of more than 10,000 people, culminating the end of a 15-day march from Chiapas to call attention to the systematic denial of civil rights for the region's indigenous communities by the Mexican government. The Zapatistas had initially begun their rebellion as a protest over the North American Free Trade Agreement, a treaty with the United States, which has had a disastrous impact on Mexico's rural economies. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 12th in 1864, General Carleton, commander of the Department of New Mexico, wrote an insightful letter to a fellow general regarding the recent surrender of the Navajo people. The letter proclaimed, quote, they found it was their destiny, too, as it had been that of tribe after tribe, to give way to the insatiable progress of our race. They threw down their arms and have come to us with confidence in our magnanimity. Talk about a perfect example of white supremacy and sense of entitlement. And they teach us that manifest destiny was a noble concept. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
More bad news on March 12, 1992 in Guatemala. Efren Bamaca, husband of U.S. activist Jennifer Harvey, is seized by the military in the employ of the CIA. He is later tortured and killed. This week in radical history from March 13th, only have two items, 1864. First contingent of 1,430 Navajo reach Fort Sumter, New Mexico, during the Long Walk of the Navajo, a 400-mile forced march in which thousands would die. Also in spring of 1932 in this date, hunger marches take place throughout the country, and bonus marchers are expelled from Washington, D.C. The bonus marchers were World War I vets denied their bonuses for fighting all those years earlier. The current military would rush the encampment of the World War I vets with bayonets and tanks, showing once again how disposable our vets are once they're all used up. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, March 14th in 1794, Eli Whitney patented the cotton gin. The cotton gin, a machine that quickly separated cotton from the seeds inside, greatly sped up cotton production and increased demand for the plant. As a result, the African slave trade in America, which had been losing popularity, saw a great resurgence and the slave population increased by millions. Although Whitney is given credit for the invention of the cotton gin, there is evidence that the true inventor was actually a slave. Slaves who were not even considered full human beings had no rights to patents. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on March 14, 1912, IWW workers, industrial workers of the world, agree to terms granting wage increases as 10,000 strikers gather and vote, successfully ending the Bread and Roses Lawrence textile strike. The strike was predicated on wage cuts and horrendous working conditions in Lawrence. Martial law had been declared by the city-owned big business. Workers were arrested, some sent to jail for a year. A young Syrian striker, John Ramey, was bayoneted to death and a pregnant woman beat so badly by police that she gave birth to a dead baby as the strike dragged on. But the workers refused to give in, and when the raises were won, the strikers insisted that the largest increase go to the lowest paid amongst them. This is also the end of this week's This Week in Radical History, which was produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Thanks to the Radio Roots crew at WBAI and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio for the audio I borrowed and abused. So did you like the shorter version or do you like the longer lengths? Let me know what you think by contacting me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's one long run-on word and address, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Got to run. This may be the end, but as always and forever, I am yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
We'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't.
slowly learning that fact.
We have a number of tools that we can impose to try to make sure that surveillance is compatible with our democratic values. And then, you know, finally, though, I think the precursor for that is to have more transparency. The government has to come clean about what exactly it's doing and how it's interpreting the laws and how it's using them to collect information about us, so that we can understand, the system and figure out where reform is required.
Jennifer Granick, her book is American Spies, Modern Surveillance and Why You Should Care and What to Do About It. Jennifer, thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Sheckman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.
WZBC in Newton. Okay, that brings us up to 8 o'clock, or close to it. And that will be this week in Palestine. And once again, John Roberts has done a wonderful job putting this together. And following that, we'll have a recording that Stan Robinson made at the Community Church of Boston about Venezuela. So, let us get started with This Week in Palestine. Oh, before I do this, my name is Bob Funk. You are listening to Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC Newton. Any views expressed do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. Okay, and here we go.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. And this is your host, John Roberts. The Great March of Return continues in Gaza, as does the slaughter by the Israeli snipers who openly shoot at protesters walking toward the wall that imprisons them in Gaza. Several of the protesters have died, but mostly the snipers shoot to maim, aiming at feet and legs. When one thinks of the barbarity by Israel, which imprisons Gazans behind a huge wall, and have their soldiers shoot unarmed protesters when they get too close to that precious wall. In a moment you will hear Ahmed Abu Artema, a founder of the Great March of Return, but first I want to read an excerpt from Jen Marlowe, a journalist who writes in Mondeweis, describing her experience on one of these historic marches to the wall. And here I quote, "I stared at Yusuf al-Daye's selfie. High cheekbones, light brown hair, much of it under a baseball cap, thick eyebrows slightly raised, lending an air of surprise to an otherwise pensive, soulful 14-year-old face. The Great March earlier that day had been a blur of action. Ribbons of tear gas and repeated bursts of live fire, sometimes followed by shouts of, "Someone's wounded!" Was the last of these incidents that I witnessed the moment that Youssef had been shot in the chest and killed? That afternoon, Fadi and I headed to Malacca, east of Gaza City, so that I could observe the Great Return March. The weekly demonstrations at the barrier separating Gaza from Israel began on March 30th, protesting the Israeli siege on Gaza and demanding the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their native villages. According to Al-Mezan, Center for Human Rights, nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed since the start of the march, and over 14,000 others wounded. Fadi buckled his flak jacket as we walked towards the lush green fields on which the separation fence had been erected. Fruit, vegetables, and olive groves had once grown here, Fadi explained to me. But in recent years, Israeli soldiers shot at farmers they deemed too close to the barrier. Farmers began growing wheat, which required little maintenance aside from planting and harvesting, thus reducing their risk. Since the start of the demonstrations, however, the fields could not be used for agriculture at all. The demonstration had yet to get fully underway. A few hundred people, the majority of them children, girls and young women among them, hurled stones towards a metal fence approximately 150 meters away as Israeli army jeeps drove back and forth along the dirt road and just beyond. "You see those mounds of dirt?" Fadi pointed to. They look like massive anthills. That's where snipers are. Two boys, no older than 11 or 12, carry tires to further fuel a plume of black smoke as a distinctive pop and sizzle of tear gas canisters permeated the air. And then a sharper crack. "Live fire," Fadi said. A moment later, the protesters all dashed towards one spot as shouts of, "Someone's wounded," rang out. I zoomed my video camera on the mass of youth. Moments later, medics emerged from the crowd carrying a young man on a stretcher. I caught a quick look at his bloodied leg as the stretcher passed us en route to a waiting ambulance. Media cameras jostled each other to get better view as the medics loaded the youth onto the ambulance. I turned my attention to a field. A handful of kids were running closer to the barrier, darting back and forth when tear gas enveloped them. One teenager triumphantly grabbed a freshly shot canister, gas still spouting forth, and hurled it back towards the jeeps. I was so intent on filming this moment that I almost missed the sound of live fire, followed once again by calls of, "Someone's wounded!" I shifted my camera towards the demonstrators running to the site of the injury, with the medics emerging with the wounded on a stretcher. A young man with brown Adidas shirt caught my eye. I noticed his metal crutches immediately, but it took me a moment to realize that his right jeans leg was pinned up above the knee. He agreed to an interview, wrapping a black and white keffiyeh around his face to conceal his identity. His name was Atala, he tells us, and he was 18 years old. He had lost his leg at this very encampment on April 13, 2018. He returned to the protest 4 months later after his release from the hospital. He comes to encourage the other youth to protest and to cross the barrier. "They're afraid of the occupation," he said. "You're not scared?" I asked him. "No. I'm not afraid of death. I'm only afraid of God." Atala insisted that his life has not changed at all since the amputation of his leg. Even when Fadi pressed the question, "No, no, it's just the same as before. I'm moving, I'm running, I'm walking, the same as anyone else." Atala made his way on his crutches towards a group of children and youth slinging stones with slingshots at an armored car, black smoke billowing. Approximately 4 p.m., the sound of more live fire. I directed my camera towards the cry of, "There's an injury," when a tear gas canister landed a few meters behind us. The wind carried the gas in our direction. Eyes burning, Fadi and I decided it was time to leave. We headed to his car, passing a group of chanting adults marching towards the field. The numbers had swelled to several thousand since our arrival. That was an excerpt from a Mondo Weiss article written by Jen Marlowe, describing the scene at the weekly Great March of Return in Gaza. And now we will hear from one of the founders of the Great March of Return, who was on tour in the United States and recently spoke at the Harvard Law School. Ahmed Abu Adama is a Palestinian journalist and peace activist. He's the author of the book Organized Chaos, and he has written several articles. He's a refugee from Al-Ramla village in Palestine. Here is Ahmed Abu Artema with introductory statements from the moderator, Amal Bishara, professor at Tufts University.
Thank you all for being here this evening, a really, really special and important evening for us as a community. I'm going to start with a few welcomes and thank yous and also some ground rules. I'll start with the ground rules first. First of all, I want to just... You know, this is, of course, fundamentally, in one way, an event about freedom of expression, about the bold protest that has been going on in Palestine for almost a year now. Of course, freedom of expression is an issue that we all need to protect and cultivate here at Harvard Law School as well. So with that in mind, I would ask the audience to refrain from interrupting today's event. Filming or recording this event is prohibited unless you've been given express permission by the organizers. And obviously, we want to show each other respect. As we're in this important space together. So thank you all for being a part of this conversation in that way. I want to welcome you all and thank you for being here, and especially also thank our incredible organizers, the Palestinian Caucus at Harvard Kennedy School, the There's a lot of them, so hold your applause. Palestine Solidarity Committee, Harvard Law School Justice for Palestine, the Palestinian Community of Boston, Jewish Voice for Peace Boston, United for Justice with Peace, Massachusetts Peace Action, the Alliance for Water Justice, American Friends Service Committee, and a special thanks to some of the people who've been putting in so much organizing effort, particularly Randa Wahbi, Jihad Abu Salim with the AFSC, Reem Jafari, and Asma Jaber. So we're very grateful for all the effort that allowed us to be here today. I also want to start by recognizing that, of course, Harvard University is located on the lands of Wampanoag, Pawtucket, and Massachusetts tribal nations, that of course the U.S. settler colonial project continues here and continues to do violence to indigenous lives and lands. Just as we think about the way in which the Nakba continues in Palestine, we need to think about the toll that settler colonialism takes right here on the ground where we are gathered. This history and this present must inform our approach to learning, expression, and activism here in Cambridge and beyond. It is truly, truly a deep honor to be here, invited to introduce Ahmed Abu Artema, a journalist, a poet, activist, father, author of the book Organized Chaos, which I need to get my hands on, published, as many of you know, in The Nation, The New York Times, the Journal of Palestine Studies, Al Jazeera, among many, many, many other outlets. And, of course, also the founder of the Great March of Return. I'd don't want to say too much here, but I do want to just mark how important this is as a community for us to be greeting you here today. So I will say a few words. Ahmed Aburtama was born in 1984. When he was born, that means that Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza was 17 years old. The dispossession of his family's hometown in the Ramla district of Palestine was 36 years old. So he was born about perhaps a half hour, 40 minutes from your family's hometown, about. He grew up under military occupation, under what for many people were false hopes of the Oslo Accord, against which he's spoken out, been very critical of the Oslo Accords, against what he writes about as the division and despair that they've sown among Palestinians. He's witnessed Palestinian separation, Israel's suffocating siege of Gaza, and three ferocious Israeli wars on Gaza in the last 10 years that have left, among many, many other tolls, 53% of the population of Gaza living in poverty, which is defined as less than $4.6 a day. Two-thirds of those people who are living in poverty are also managing in the deep poverty of not having enough money to cover the very most basic needs of shelter, clothing, and food. In these dire circumstances, Ahmed Aburtama opened up a renewed path for Palestinian resistance, asking last year what would happen if thousands of Gazans, most of them refugees, attempted to peacefully cross the fence that separated Palestinians from their ancestral lands. The result of this bold proposition was the Great Return March. Since it began almost a year ago, Palestinians experiencing some of the most harsh, some of the harshest forms of Israeli repression have led us all to imagine a better future through courageous, loving, persistent acts of resistance day after day, week after week. The Great Return March is so deeply rooted in Palestinian histories of resistance, and in a beautiful way, it has helped us to rebuild a Palestinian unity despite geographic separation, both in the way that you envisioned this protest, but also in the way that it's mobilized Palestinians across so many different places. The Great Return March began with protests at the fence that separates Gazan families from their lands. And, of course, also, this is a fence that's so important to think about what this really means. It's also a fence on one side of which live people who have a life expectancy 10 years longer than on the other side of the fence. So this is a fence for us to really think about racism and apartheid and death. The Land Day is a very important day in Palestinian tradition as well. Since 1976, Land Day has been a day of Palestinian protest and commemoration, marking a day when seven Palestinians in the Galilee inside Israel were killed by Israeli forces as they protested land confiscations. And Land Day has been marked every year since then as a way of practicing Palestinian connection to the land. And of course, it was also planned to mobilize Palestinians during the season of protest that occurs in one way or another every year between March 30th and Nakba Day of March 14th. And of course, last year was one of a pivotal year to commemorate the Nakba because it marked 70 years of Palestinian dispossession. And it's important to note that this protest builds on a heritage of Palestinian popular resistance, on the 1936-1939 Great Revolt against British rule, and on the 1987 to the early 90s Intifada against Israeli occupation. And of course, Palestinian popular resistance has gone on basically every day since the Nakba in one way or another. It also innovates on this tradition as well with a determination to build a new society in and around protest, with a role for nurses, for journalists, for teachers, for young and old, men and women, not only for flag flyers, but also kite flyers and balloon blowers. A mode of protest that invites families to join for picnics and then invites prayer to happen on that sacred ground of protest, of struggle and protest. The Great Return March links together so many issues at the core of the struggle for Palestinian rights, and in that way stands for all Palestinians. It helps us think about and struggle against that deadly fence that separates Gazans from the rest of Palestinians and from, in many ways, from the rest of the world. The Palestinians in the Great Return March are standing in struggle against siege. They're struggling for the Palestinian right of return, for Palestinians' struggle for a better life with dignity, and a struggle against racism, this racism that allows Israel to treat Palestinians as if our lives matter less or don't matter at all. It's a struggle for Palestinians' ongoing relationship to our beautiful lands. And in struggling for justice in these most difficult circumstances, Palestinians in the Great Return March are a model for all of us, Palestinian or not, who see how integrally connected is, can be, and should be global movements for a life free from racism, militarization, walls, poverty, and displacement. It's a model for all of us who are part of a global movement for a life in which communities can expect the next generation to grow up in a livable environment with freedom of movement and also the freedom to be rooted with dignity in our own homes and our own lands. So, you know, the Great March of Return has inspired Palestinians in Gaza, obviously in Gaza, but also in Haifa, in Ramallah, in Beirut, in many places around the world, and it's also surely inspired us as a community in Boston. Last year, we were honored to be able to read your words at our 70th commemoration of the Nakba. We felt the power of your organizing, of your resistance, of your determination to continue despite that day's horribly bloody news of Israel's repression of protest that day that left more than 58 people dead. And so I'm very, very grateful to be able to welcome you here to Cambridge and to Boston on behalf of the community. Thank you. And also to recognize the extraordinary organizing work of Jihad al-Muslim with the AFSC. Thank you. Sorry.
Good evening, Boston. It is my pleasure. Can people hear me? It is my pleasure to be here with you today. I'm going to say a few words before I invite Ahmed to the stage. My name is Jihad Abu Salim. I'm from a small town called Deir al-Balah, 6 miles south of Gaza City. It's my hometown. It's where I grew up. It's where I spent most of my life. I've been in the U.S. for 5 years, and in those 5 years, I haven't been able to go at least once to Gaza and see my family. My siblings grew up, they became older, and I kind of no longer kind of recognize my dad when I FaceTime him every once in a while as age has grown on him. I would like to thank the organizers of this great event. I would like to honor the great work of those people who work tirelessly day and night, working with us, to make this moment possible and to allow us to be in this space with you all here tonight. Although I gave many talks and went to many lectures in the 5 years of my journey in America, this moment tonight feels like no other moment. I started working with AFSC in Chicago in summer of 2018. I was interviewed for the job back in March, and I had my orientation day on March 29th of that year. Around the time I was about to leave the office, I told my colleagues to be, tomorrow there will be a March of Return in Gaza. What will that be about? What's the scale of it? These were questions that most of us didn't know the answers to. I couldn't sleep that night, as my brain was overwhelmed by thoughts about Gaza and about the people there, about the destiny of people who live with me on the same street, about people who I knew they will be going to the fence and might never return to their families and friends again. So the idea of marching for return has reverberated throughout Palestinian history. It's not a novel idea or a new one. But what the Great March of Return has done is that it revived this notion of moving from calling for the right of return to actually marching east to call for its implementation, because Palestinians do have the right to return to their towns and villages. The idea of marching, of having some sort of a mass popular mobilization in Gaza, started in summer of 2017 when Palestinians in Jerusalem had their uprising against the metal detectors that the Israeli authorities installed outside of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was a great moment for Palestinians, unprecedented in a long time, that thanks to mass popular mobilization, the masses in Jerusalem were capable of undoing the policies of the Israeli authorities. That inspired a conversation in Gaza that my friend Ahmed here was part of. And that conversation that happened mostly on social media. Social media is the front for where young people, intellectuals, young intellectuals, activists, academics, people who have no platform, talk and engage in these ideas. This is an idea that came from the grassroots. This is an idea that has been part of the Palestinian consciousness and part of the Palestinian discourse for many years, and it will still be there for many years to come. The events that unfolded in Gaza last year highlight two important issues that I would like all of us tonight to keep in mind. It highlighted the Palestinian refugee plight and the decade-long blockade on Gaza. There is a sense of urgency when it comes to the blockade, but also there are larger political questions that the march also hoped to raise our awareness on. We organized this tour at AFSC and working with our great partners and friends in order to bring this conversation back in Gaza that is under blockade, that is not supposed to be here according to the laws of occupation. We organized this tour so that this conversation can be here with you and so that you can be part of this conversation as well. So I invite you tonight with me and with my dear friends here to celebrate Ahmed's presence with us as an act of breaking the blockade on Gaza, and invite you to listen, to open your heart and mind, no matter how you agree or disagree with the things he will say. After all, he was a prisoner, that he's just tasting a moment of freedom, and soon he will be back to the prison of Gaza to dwell with 2.2 million people in a prison that has never shown them mercy for the many years that passed. So let's open our hearts and minds. Let's listen. Let's listen and talk and ask questions with good faith and with love and with a hope in mind that after listening to his words, that one day with his words and with the actions of those who sacrifice their lives every day, that one day there will be a better future for all the people, not only in Palestine, but everywhere. Thank you so much, Anna, and please join me in welcoming Ahmed Abateh.
Thank you. Good evening. At first, I would like to thank all the organizers of this great event. Thank you very much. Brothers and sisters, peace and blessing be upon you. In nearly every part of the world we live in, it's possible for one to decide to travel and then return home. I come to you from a place where living is subject to such extreme restrictions. One might spend years trying to travel without success. My being in front of you today is a personal success story. It's evidence of how lucky I am compared to many fellow Palestinians who never traveled even once in their lives. I came to you from Gaza Strip, which is a small part of Palestine. It's a narrow strip of land with an area of 141 square miles. 2.2 million Palestinians live there, making it one of the highest population density territories in the world. 70% of the residents of the Gaza Strip are Palestinian refugees, expelled by Israel in 1948. My attempt to travel started 6 years ago, in 2013, and all efforts were not successful. I was always told that travel permits are only granted to patients who need necessary medical treatment, for students who seek to go to university, and for people with resident students who seek to return to countries in which they reside. I would say, I'm a human being who has the natural right to move freely. I want to explore the world and meet people from diverse cultures and countries. Isn't this enough of a justification for me to travel? The Gaza Strip links with the outside world throughout two crossings of Gaza residents. The first is in Rafah, south of Gaza on the border with Egypt. Borders with Egypt. This crossing is known for its long delays. Many people wait months to leave. In 2017, for example, the Rafah crossing opened only for 29 days throughout the entire year. It was more often closed than open. The other crossing out of Gaza is Eretz in the north. Traveling through Eretz requires a special permit by the Israeli authorities, which they rarely grant. The sea borders Gaza from the west. The sea is completely controlled by the Israeli military ships. Although Israel claimed it withdrew from Gaza in 2005, no one is ever allowed to travel or leave Gaza by boat. Nor are Palestinians allowed to build the seaport which could connect them to the outside world. As for leaving Gaza by air, Israeli tanks and warplanes completely destroyed the Gaza airport in 2001, only 3 years after it was built. My first thought after I left Gaza was how happy I felt that I would be able to travel freely at last. It felt great to travel in the car without reading a sign that says the area in which you are allowed to move has ended. It was a beautiful feeling to move freely without seeing fences or walls. Dear sisters and brothers, on the 9th of December 2017, 3 days after President Trump announced he is going to move the embassy to occupied Jerusalem, I went for a walk with my friend Hassan near the fence separating the Gaza Strip from Israel. My friend Hassan pointed towards the east, saying, "Look, this is the fence separating us from our villages, from which our families were expelled." I was amazed that this fence imprisons 2.2 million people in the narrow Gaza Strip, preventing them from freedom of movement and a normal life. That night, I posted on my Facebook. It was the moment before sunset. I looked at the birds and I saw them moving between the trees on both sides of the fence, and no one stopped them. How easy the matter is. Birds decide to fly, so they fly. What if one of us imagine himself a bird and then decide to reach a tree beyond the fence? If that person was from Gaza or from West Bank, once they reach the fence, a bullet will hit his body. What's the business of this bullet to kill his dream as if he committed a crime? Why do we complicate the simple matters? Isn't it the right of humans to move freely like birds? What danger toward peace would a human create if he or she decided to wander in nature? On that day, I discovered the real reason to hate the occupation. I hate it because it disrupts my evening walk, because it's against the laws of nature. It kills my dreams. At the beginning of 2018, the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip was making for Palestinians worse than ever. The destruction of health services, the cutting of employees' salaries, the paralyzed economy, and the continuation of the closure made life impossible. I wrote another Facebook post where I suggested that 200,000 Palestinians gather peacefully near the fence to demand a life with dignity. and to return to their lands and homes. In this post, I said that we are people who want life, and nothing but life. We die in our besieged narrow strip, so why don't we move before we all die? I ended this post with the proposed hashtag, Great March Return. Many people answered this call. They did so because 70% of Gaza's residents are refugees who were expelled by force from their villages and cities that are just beyond the fence. People answered this call because the Gaza Strip, according to the reports of the United Nations, won't be livable in 2020, just next year, because of the collapse of basic human services. People answer the call for peaceful protest because their desire for life was stronger than despair. The Great March represented a scream for life and a knock on the walls of the prison after these besieged prisoners decided not to accept continuation of a slow death. On March 30 last year, the day the Great March of Return was launched, tens of thousands of Palestinians peacefully protested near the fence. On that day, women, men, elderly and children together participated in the march and raised the keys of their houses in Israel. And Palestinians in Gaza still protest every Friday for almost a year. They raised the Palestinian flag and said, "We want to return. We want a dignified life. We want human rights like the rest of all people and nations of the world." What did Israel do to face those peaceful protesters? Israel opened fire at them and shot them with explosive live bullets, killing on that day and until this day more than 260 Palestinians. 25,000 more have been injured. Many of them lost their limbs. Among the victims of the return march were medics, journalists, and women and children. Maybe some of you heard the story of the paramedic Razan al-Najjar, who was killed by an Israeli bullet to her chest. Razan, a beautiful young woman, volunteered to help the wounded at the protests. She was wearing the white uniform of paramedic when she was killed, somehow thinking that her uniform would protect her in the eyes of an Israeli sniper. The Israeli army killed Razan and killed her dream of a humane world where peace prevails. I visited Razan's mother, who told me about her angel daughter. She told me that she once asked Razan, What if you saw an injured Israeli soldier while you are helping the wounded Palestinians?" Razan answered, "I will help him with no hesitation. With no hesitation. My mission is humane and doesn't distinguish between people." Why does Israel target and kill peaceful protesters? Why? It kills them because it wants to target the will to live, the will to resist the occupation in the spirit of the Palestinian people. The protesters raised their voice after 70 years of attempts to silence us. The March of Return sends a message that millions of refugees must return simply because this is their right. The return of refugees is not theoretical proposition. It's also practically achievable. 85% of lands on which refugees lived before Israel expelled them in 1948 is still either empty or with low population density until now. If the world had the will, it would be able to put an end to the tragedy of those millions of refugees and compensate for their losses, making it possible for them to live in peace with their Jewish neighbors. We want a solution based on the foundation of justice, equality, and freedom. A country where indigenous Palestinians coexist with their Jewish neighbors according to the values of citizenship, equal rights, and the implementation of international justice. While the Jewish people have a right to live in peace and security, it's not fair or just to solve a tragedy by creating a new one. Sisters and brothers, Israel didn't only kill us since the beginning of the Great March of Return. Israel killed us first when it expelled our people by force from our villages and towns in 1948. Israel killed us again with military occupation in 1967. Israel killed us by imposing a blockade, depriving us from our most basic rights. And now we are killed. We are killed with explosive bullets when we decided to scream and say at the fence, "No to death, we want our life." Can you imagine, my sisters and my brothers, can you imagine how people live in Gaza? If you were a young person in Gaza, you may turn 35 years old without ever getting a job, a place of your own to live, or be able to get married. To be a father in Gaza often means you feel ashamed because you are unable to provide food for your family and for your children. To be ill in Gaza means waiting for many months to get an Israeli permit in order to exit and receive medical treatment. To live in Gaza means that you will live without electricity. We only have access 4 or 6 hours of electricity. Then it cuts off for 12 to 16 hours. To be a young person in Gaza means you spend your whole life without seeing a river, or a mountain, or a lake. You won't take the train, use an escalator, or connect with people from different countries and different cultures. You won't even see a civilian plane in the sky carrying passengers. Since I left Gaza, I'm still excited every time I see a plane in the sky. I stop and stare at the plane until it disappears in the horizon. In Gaza, we see planes in the sky, but only Israeli military planes. The sound of the plane is linked in the hearts of people to death and horror. It has hard for us to imagine that planes are symbols for life and activity. Israel claims the blockade of the Gaza Strip punishes a certain faction. But in fact, it's a policy of collective punishment against 2.2 million human beings. These crimes are committed by a state that it defines itself as a democratic state, then seeks to achieve its political ends by imposing collective punishment on patients, civilians, and the children. Brothers and sisters, is it acceptable that entire nations remain imprisoned between walls and fences forever? Is it acceptable that relations between people remains defined by injustice committed by the powerful against the powerless, discriminating against them and depriving them of their rights? In a world of justice and equality, we could use our resources to build a better life for all and not for purposes of war and aggression. A world where people live connected and safe will be better for everyone. Will be better for everyone. Much better than a world of fences, walls, and fear. Let us stand in the right side of history for a better future for our children. We struggle today for freedom, dignity, and justice for all people. For all people. Thank you.
You have been listening to Ahmed Abu Ardama, a founder of the Great March of Return in Gaza. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
That rat face could do a thing like that.
She's got no heart in her. She's a swivel-eyed get.
She wants pole axing.
Some people have knocked on their own mother. They're living in a jungle, yeah, I don't know.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. With me, Tony Gosling, and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Never mind the Saudi prince Mohammed bin Salman's bloody role in Yemen. What about his role in the 9/11 attacks and his royal family? We're joined by author of 9/11 The New Evidence and organiser of UK-based Reinvestigate 9/11, which is calling for a proper inquiry into the real perpetrators of the 2001 9/11 attacks. Ian Henshaw. Also, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn's call for a ban on UK arms sales, not to Saudi Arabia, but to Israel. Why has he done it? And more importantly, why has it not been reported anywhere in the UK press? It's in the Israeli newspapers, but not here. And links between the Israelis and the Indian government may have played a part in the recent bomb attack in Kashmir, inflaming tensions between two nuclear-armed states. Why is veteran Middle East journalist Robert Fisk pointing his finger at Tel Aviv? Is he an anti-Semite too? And the Northern Ireland Troubles, possibly reopening of the case against the British Army on Bloody Sunday, as the Northern Ireland Secretary says in the Commons that the police and army were above the law. Their killings weren't crimes. And she's still in her job. A documentary also has been suppressed about the supposedly loyalist Lochan Island massacre. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, a new political discussion group for Bristol based at Triodos Bank. And also turmoil over gender reassignment in the Bristol Labour Party, with Pamela Beamish and Esther Giles being banned from standing two Labour members as candidates for alleged statements relating to the matter. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. We start by welcoming Ian Henshaw to the studio. Thanks very much for dropping by, Ian.
It's a pleasure.
Could you just give us a brief outline of the Saudi links to the September the 11th attacks? Because we've seen a lot of criticism of Saudi Arabia this week again, and also the exposure over the last couple of months that they've for a long time had top-level intelligence links to Israel. But can we start with the links to the 9/11 attacks, which we were told, really, weren't we, that something was going on in Afghanistan, but actually it was bin Laden, and he's a Saudi?
Well, Tony, you know, it would take me a lot longer than you've got to list all those links, and we're not talking speculation, we're talking about officially admitted statements. You know, we've got leaks from, well, we've got stuff that the FBI has been forced to reveal. We've got Inspector General's reports into the CIA activities at the time of 9/11. And what's coming out, beyond any serious doubt, based on FBI agents who handled the case, yes, Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian government was involved in the 9/11 attacks. Nobody is really denying that.
Okay,
now.
So how exactly?
How? They supplied the alleged hijackers. We don't really know if those guys really did fly the planes or not, but they were very crucial to the official story. They were supplied by Saudi Arabia, and they were given visas by the American State Department when they should never have been given visas.
So how come you say they? We don't know if they flew the planes or not? Well, I mean, surely that's a basic part of the investigation.
Well, that's the official story, but we also know there was an anti-hijack operation going on that morning, which probably involved
an exercise,
just a coincidence, we're told. But that anti-hijack exercise would have involved remote control of aircraft, taking them over. The reason this sounds, you know, far-fetched, the reason people are thinking down those lines is because at least one of the pilots was obviously hopelessly unqualified and could not possibly have flown the plane the way he did. So either somebody else, either they haven't got the right people, or the planes weren't flown by suicide hijackers. They weren't steered.
What do pilots, professional pilots, have to say about this?
Professional pilots are amazingly unwilling to make any comments. Architects and engineers, there's thousands of them saying how, you know, the towers couldn't have collapsed the way they appeared to.
I've seen some stuff about some professional pilots have made comments on the amazing manoeuvre that was supposed to have been done by the aircraft that supposedly hit the Pentagon.
The Pentagon, I know, exactly. And that pilot, the alleged pilot of that, he'd been, you can find it on record, you know, he'd been dismissed from flight schools.
Hani
Hanjour was kicked out of flight schools because he wasn't considered safe on a small plane. And we're now told to believe that he flew a big plane down, you know, almost a military, it was described at the time as a military manoeuvre, and then flew at ground level, and then just happened to hit the part of the Pentagon that had just been recently reinforced and was empty of people, by and large empty of people. The 9/11 is full of these bizarre stories, and if it was anybody but the official sources telling us these things, they'd be laughed out of court as conspiracy theories.
What about remote control of aircraft? Have you got any actual real hard evidence that that's possible?
Oh, it is possible. I mean, they've had drone aircraft since the Second World War. The only question is, you know, what was happening on 9/11? That's just a theory. It's just a possibility. But it's, you have to come up with something, because Hani Hanjour couldn't have flown that plane.
Why do you think the Saudis did get involved, if they did get involved? What was the motive there?
Well, I'll just read out a couple of quotes I've just been sifting through Newsweek. And the interesting thing is that you can now find out things in the mainstream American media, which only people like me and you were saying 10 years ago. We've turned out to be, dare I say it, horribly right, and now they're finally admitting it. Government-wide cover-up, that's what Newsweek are calling it. New York Post... Bandar, Prince Bandar, the Saudi leader, sorry, the Saudi ambassador to the United States at the time, he was a very close friend of George Bush. Bandar should have been a suspect, and that's what the FBI thought. Instead of giving him a special entourage to protect him from arrest and flying him home as quickly as they did, they could have. He should actually have been a suspect. He should be in jail. Saudi Arabia and the CIA conspired. That's Newsweek. So that gets back to your question: why would the Saudis do it? Saudis don't do anything without the say-so from America. And recently they've admitted now that that's when they set up their string of Wahhabist Saudi, Islamic sort of setups all over the world. Mosques.
Sort of schools, colleges.
Yeah, the schools, like that, the colleges and madrasas. And they've admitted now, the new guy, KSM or whatever he's called, he's now admitting...
MBS.
he's now admitting, or he's stated, that, you know, they did it because the Americans asked them to. This wasn't something that happened, oh dear, you know, like the American establishment will tell you publicly, oh dear, the Saudis are a little bit naughty, they're beyond our control. No. And here we are saying CIA and Saudi Arabia conspired, and that's Newsweek. That's not Tony or Ian, that's Newsweek. Why won't the rest of the media take any notice of it? Heaven alone knows. Why have they taken 10 years to tell us this, what was obvious from the statements of FBI officers 10 years ago? Goodness knows. For some reason they decided to tell us.
I'll put up a link on our show page to those articles you've just, the headlines you've just read out at thisweek.org.uk. So if you don't believe us, just go and have a look and ask yourself, why is the mainstream press not covering this? What's your answer to that question?
I think that, I mean, I don't have an easy answer. I used to spend hours talking to a guy on The Independent, and when he finally, I gave him the story, you know, all based on American sources, he didn't have to believe a word of me. You know, it doesn't matter who I was. I gave him the references to read it in the government reports and the statements of FBI officers. They just wouldn't run it. And I thought, well, I don't know why he spent hours talking to me and then wouldn't run something that was rock solid. Instead, they went with another story about the Saudis involved in 9/11, which is a perfectly good story. But the really key one is about the CIA's involvement in 9/11 and the way they protected the alleged hijackers from being arrested by the FBI. And there's some very angry people now in Washington who are beginning to realise that the CIA is up to its eyeballs in the 9/11 attacks. We don't know quite how. We don't know if they were just stupid. It rather looks as if they knew exactly what they were doing. They kept the information as to what they were up to from the guy who they should have been reporting to, who's now very angry, a guy called Richard Clark. He'll tell anybody who listens that he was deceived and never should have been left out in the out of the loop by the CIA. They had no legal right to do that. He was in charge of the CIA from the White House, and he never knew nothing about these hijackers that the CIA knew all about.
Is anyone from the heart of government in the early noughties spoken out, gone public and said, well, look, you know, this is a government conspiracy to cover this up?
Well, the most interesting guy who has said that is a guy called von Bülow, Andreas von Bülow, who's a West German politician, and he brought out a book that was in, the title was The CIA and 9/11, and within 2 years of 9/11, or even, I think even of a year, he'd come to that conclusion. He's probably the biggest expert on the intelligence services in the whole of the political world. He sat on a committee that was investigating the German intelligence services, who from time to time get caught out organising right-wing, extreme right-wing groups, which they then run. That's another story. You've probably run that, I don't know.
What about the links then between Saudi Arabia and the United States? Because we've got, I think it was 1945, the Great Bitter Lake meeting between Roosevelt and Abdulaziz, who was then the king of Saudi Arabia. This seems to have kind of started a very strong... I mean, actually, you could even go back to the First World War.
Well, I was just going to say...
And the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which the British put in place.
Yeah.
What is the nature
Lawrence
of that...
Lawrence of Arabia.
What is the nature of that sort of post-World War II relationship between the US and Saudi Arabia? Obviously, oil is flowing in one direction. Is it just money going the other way, or is it other parts of that deal, do you think?
We pay our money for their oil, and then they use what was our money to buy our arms. So really what's happening is that there's a sort of hidden tax. The price we pay for oil represents a hidden tax, which is then used to subsidise the military-industrial complex. And Saudi, I'm not an expert on this, but I think you'll speak to military experts, they'll tell you Saudi Arabia is paying well over the market price, like 10 times, you know, really seriously over the market price for the arms that we supply them, because it's just an accounting scam, basically.
Martin, we've got keep hearing, actually, over the last 4 or 5 years about the oil price falling. It's not falling at the petrol pumps here by any means, is it? In fact, it's edging up even more.
Well, the other aspect of the relationship between the Saudis and the Americans is the petrodollar system. Essentially, because the Saudis are the dominant force in OPEC because of their oil, they've got the biggest oil reserves, they've enforced that OPEC countries will only take payments for oil in dollars. Now, that means that the dollar is the world's reserve currency. Before 1971, the dollar was the world's reserve currency, was based on gold. The petrodollar system is based up because you've got to have dollars to buy oil.
But those dollars aren't necessarily based on anything. They just
dollars. Well, no, they're just printed. But of course, the point is, every country in the world has to have a low pile of dollars to buy their oil, and that means that the Americans can run a massive budget deficit. They can run the military-industrial complex on tick. Yeah, but the whole thing is dependent. The whole thing is absolutely interrelated, and of course, it's potentially going to crash because the Chinese and the Russians are looking to create an alternative currency system where their currencies, the yuan and the ruble, will be based ultimately on gold. There'll still be some movement for it. The Bretton Woods system did allow some flexibility, and ultimately if the dollar is taken away as the world's reserve currency, the US economy will crash, and that will be the end of their empire.
Well, we're always hearing about Saudi Arabia's massive oil reserves, but actually the largest oil reserves in the world are in Venezuela, which has really been hotting up over the last few weeks. What's your take on Maduro and what's been happening there, Martin?
Well, the Venezuelan oil is a very poor quality, although there's apparently a lot of good quality oil just in a disputed area between Venezuela and Guyana, which is another issue. Well, what's happened? They've basically been very, very open about the fact that they're going to get rid. I mean, Pompeo the other week was saying that Maduro could end up like Gaddafi, and he also said, he might end up on a beach somewhere, like in Guantanamo. And of course, Maduro is the elected president of Venezuela. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls and everything, he won the election. The opposition boycotted the election because they knew they couldn't win. But he had a turnout comparable to any turnout in US elections, and he won 64% of that vote, which is far higher than most politicians of the West, far higher than Donald Trump or Theresa May, for example. But he's not allowed to be the president because we've declared some other guy, Guaido. Most 80% of people in Venezuela hadn't heard who Guaido was when the Americans declared him president. So most people didn't even know who he was. But an outside power has declared him president, and they've also threatened to invade. This is very dangerous, but the fact is, it's not worked.
Venezuela is surrounded by US proxy states, isn't it?
Hostile states, yeah.
Brazil, really, ultra-left, neo-Nazi, effectively, state in Brazil, or certainly fascist government. Has Maduro got the wherewithal? We just heard yesterday, didn't we, by the way, of a massive power cut in Caracas and right across large parts of Venezuela,
which they're blaming on sabotage.
Surely, it's been a long war using dirty tricks.
There was an attempt to
The Americans might possibly be able to topple Maduro and put their own man in place.
Pompeo himself has said, if Kim Jong-un was to die suddenly, don't ask me any questions about it, but you know what the CIA is like. Yeah, they're basically being very, very gangsterish in the way they're approaching this, which has actually not worked. The population inside Venezuela, opinion polls show, 80% are opposed to sanctions and 90% are opposed to military intervention. And if it turns into a military intervention, they'll be able to get in easily enough, but then they will face an Iraq scenario because they've got a pretty good military in Venezuela. They're pretty well prepared. They've been preparing for this battle for a long time. And the US ground forces will get in easily enough, but then they'll be chewed to bits like they were in Iraq.
What would you like me to...
Well, I just wonder what your take on Venezuela and Maduro and that.
Yeah, well, I think it takes longer, you know, than we think. I think that, yes, they have threatened to invade, but I don't think the invasion is part of the plan for another few years yet. They're going to weaken the country as much as they possibly can through viciously effective sanctions. Just on the optimistic side, I read a report, perhaps you can correct me, that the Brazilians have ruled out aiding and abetting an American invasion. So they have to come in from Colombia. And, you know, and then you've got Cuba. I think it's a lot of this is bluff on the Americans' part at the moment. They're trying to persuade the public to overthrow Maduro rather than actually being...
They're trying to persuade the army, which is hopeless, because, of course, the army's been purged because of the coup in 2002. All the bad wood was kicked out at that stage.
Let's just be correct. It was a coup attempt.
A coup attempt.
Failed.
That's right. But at that point, the army, you know, don't forget Chavez was originally a paratroops lieutenant colonel. But what's happened this week, which has not been reported in the Western media, is two Russian prankster comedians who are actually well known for these things phoned up Elliot Abrahams, who's the Iran-Contra gargoyle from the past who's been put in charge of Venezuela policy. And they phoned him up pretending to be the Swiss foreign ministry. And he believed them, and he chatted with them for an hour about what the strategy was with Venezuela. And he said, we don't intend to invade, but we want to freak them out, and that eventually, you know, ultimately we're just going to try and bring them down with sanctions, etc. Now, of course, at the same time, they're trying to say we're going to bring in humanitarian aid, at the same time as the Bank of England has seized $1.5 billion of gold that the Venezuelans have in good faith deposited at the Bank of England. They said, can we have it back? He said, no, you can't.
Well,
we saw
set fire to aid trucks, but there is evidence that that was actually done by the anti-Maduro.
That was done by the anti-Maduro people to make sure they could get a picture of the aid trucks being torched, but it was their people who did it.
It's now, pretty shameful that the EU... Is the EU now officially, because its
friends
were standing...
No, so the EU officially isn't going along with it, but various EU countries are.
Right, including Britain.
Yeah.
Well, back to the 9/11 stuff. I wonder if you could just tell us, Ian, how the campaign started, the 9/11 Truth campaign here in the UK. Because, I mean, I think it took for most people a while to realise the implications of the crimes of the September 11th attacks. And the, you know, just what it was going to mean for the future, because it did take a while for us to realise, I think, it certainly did for me, that they were going to use this as an attempt to start this war on terror and to try and define the geopolitics of the 21st century.
Well, yeah, I mean, America really needed, I mean, the American ruling elite really needed something like 9/11. When you look back at the situation, you know, as it was a week before 9/11, it was looking terrible for them. Bush was extremely unpopular. Most people thought he'd stolen the election. That all went out the window with 9/11. Israel was also extremely unpopular. Colin Powell had just virtually been kicked out of a UN summit on Israel just a few weeks earlier. What else? There's pretty much everything. They'd had the World Trade plans had been stopped by the uprising in Seattle. I don't know if you remember that, but it was a major, major event at the time. And Clinton capitulated to the demands of the people like us, you know, who don't want to see the big business taking over everything, which is what the trade deals were doing. So, you know, the elite in the West was definitely beleaguered. You know, they hadn't managed to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They'd lost their influence in Afghanistan. So, and 9/11 solved all these things. And don't even let's start talking about Israel's public image, you know, and how suddenly Israel was everybody's friend because they could give you advice on anti-terrorism. You know, Muslim terror, that's our speciality, isn't it? If Israeli technical suppliers or military advisors or whatever. So, you know, that's when 9/11 sits in the general scheme of things. And how extraordinary it was that very day that the media right across the West, they all used the same thing. This changes everything. You know, this changes everything. And they meant it. We didn't quite realise, a lot of people didn't quite realise how much they did mean it.
Well, I had a little bit of a weird thing happen to me on the September the 11th itself, which was I was on an email sharing list with a friend of mine, called Martian, his nickname anyway, he called it Martian's List. And I saw just, I suppose it would be 10 a.m. here, I saw an article on the BBC which was saying that the the Chilean government were going to be prosecuting Henry Kissinger for war crimes for the coup. And that was the same morning for the 1973, I think it was, wasn't it, coup in Chile. And that he was going to be prosecuted. So basically, if he ever came and stepped foot on Chilean soil, that he would be prosecuted. Yeah. And also they were going to do what they could through international law to get him and to prosecute him and to jail him for it. And I flippantly tweeted, oh, he's going to have to start World War III now to distract our attention. And later in the day, of course, saw all this stuff going on. But, I mean, it did take me a while. I think probably the first I saw was Thierry Masson's book.
Yeah.
It was called Pentagate, I think, was the very first thing I saw, which popped through my letterbox. I picked that up and started reading it. But it slowly dawned on me, I suppose, after the first 18 months or so, that something needed to be done to scotch the lies of the 9/11. And one of the main figures who was involved in actually getting the campaign together here in the UK was Ian Neil.
Ian Neil.
And he sadly died recently of brain cancer at a very early age. I think it was 53, 50s. Something like that. Anyway, can you just say what Ian Neil's role was? Because I know you were involved in the early days too,
In
sort of starting things going, to actually bring people together and saying, well, look, we're going to have to get organised here and oppose this narrative.
Yeah, well, I just got an email, a stray email, saying somebody's called a meeting for 9/11 skeptics. I'm not sure if we were using that phrase at that point, but for people who were worried about this. And there was about eight of us in a pub, and Ian Neil was one of them. There was a sort of mixed bunch of people from different, very different political backgrounds, which has been a problem for the 9/11 Truth Movement, because talking about the major parties being split, the 9/11 Truth Movement has a range of different factions in it, you know, and some of them will tell you that other ones of them are lunatics and so on and so on. You know, I generally try to stick to what's been admitted by the governments, because, you know, you can't really, it's much harder for people in the establishment, at least, to, you know, stonewall you if you're pointing out to things that were in US government reports.
But Ian Neil was an engineer doing things like working on bringing water supplies through charities to
Africa. Oh, he was a wonderful guy.
Places like that.
He was a very high-powered guy.
What was it that drew him to it, do you think? What was his main take on it all?
I think he was basically, you know, to oversimplify, you could possibly say he was an anarchist, very suspicious of government. So, you know, I mean, that's the one thing that everybody's got in common in the 9/11 Truth Movement, is we're suspicious of government. We don't believe official statements unless we see something more substantial to back them up.
And what was his role?
Well, he did a lot of organising. He did a lot of work, really, just contacting people, trying to get support, posting onto so-called alternative websites who weren't interested. It was quite frightening the extent to which people you would expect to at least listen weren't even prepared to listen to anything about 9/11.
I mean, I think in the early days it must have been quite a thankless task.
Well, it has been for many years, Tony, I can tell you.
It still is.
But it's even more spectacular now, because you've got Newsweek, you know, you've got the American parts of the American media gradually beginning to admit and fess up. To cheer myself up, Ken Livingston apparently told one of our supporters that, you know, if we're right about 9/11, it'll be 150 years before they tell us the truth. And, you know, I don't think any of us will live that long, but who knows? I think the general public's more aware than the elite. The worst people are Guardian readers, actually, because they believe everything. If the Guardian were to tell them 9/11 was an inside job, they'd all believe it straight away. But you try telling them when the Guardian's not telling them that, it's an impossible task.
Well, Martin Summers, I know you were involved in the early days as well. What drew you to it?
Well, on the day it happened, I pretty much immediately knew that it was wrong, and a friend of mine came into the room and said, look, there's been an attack on America, isn't it great, it's about time they got their comeuppance. I said, you've got this wrong, and I realised immediately that it was wrong, and then I looked up what was going to happen. There's a seminar at the London School of Economics three weeks hence about the future of American power, where an old friend of mine, Peter Gowan, who's now dead, was going to be debating with the guy called Mort Dworkin III, political attaché at the US Embassy, about the future of American power. So I paid my 25 quid and went down to London to go to this seminar with a leaflet, which I'd got from my research on the internet, because the first thing that drew my attention was that John O'Neill, who was the deputy head of the FBI, had written a book with Brissard and Dasky, who were ex-intelligence agents from France and journalists, called Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite, and
And basically, what O'Neill was saying was that he'd been chasing down Bin Laden.
That's the forbidden truth, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, he was going to chase down Bin Laden. Every time he tried to chase down Bin Laden, he was protected by the Bush family. So I got this, and I turned it into a little leaflet, and I went to the seminar. I tried to put my hand up to speak in the seminar, and of course there's lots of windbags there, so you couldn't get a word in. And at the end of it, I just stood up with a sign saying, why did FBI man resign? Answer, because Bush was protecting Bin Laden. Anyway, the security then threw me out, because you're not allowed to protest in seminars, and they threw me out onto the pavement outside the LSE. I said, well, can I stand here on the pavement? They said, yes, you can stand there. Anyway, I just handed leaflets out to all the people who had been in the seminar. Bonnie Greer was there, if you know her, American author. So I was talking to all these people, showing them, you know, this is all the stuff about what John O'Neill had been saying. John O'Neill himself died in the attack,
yeah,
because he became head of security at the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And he died in the attack. But anyway, I didn't know that at the time. Anyway, I thought the guy was probably going to go out the back, Mort Dwork in the third. I thought he was just gone out the back. I was about to give up. But basically, he stayed inside because he didn't want to talk to me. And then he came out.
Had he spied you, you think?
He realised that I was the problem. Anyway, but I was there for about an hour and a half. I was just about to give up. He must have gone out the back way. Anyway, eventually he appeared in the doorway. And I went up to him and said, you do realise that the deputy director of the FBI resigned in June because he said Bush was protecting Bin Laden, don't you? And he was scowling, really scowling. He didn't want to talk to me. He said, yeah, John O'Neill, we know. I said, well, we know too, mate, and don't forget it. That's how I got involved.
And what about Ian Neil? Because you must have known him at fairly early.
Well, I met Ian Neil about the same time as I did my own activism on 9/11 before I came across either of you two guys.
Yeah, I remember we met up.
I met you on Stop the War demos, yeah, didn't you? And you were handing out those deception dollars. And I thought, right, this is a fellow spirit.
Yeah.
And it turned out that we both actually had been at Oxford, some people, and we knew other, yeah, people.
Some
that we
people
knew
will
people,
say, Ian Henshaw, some people will say, well, you've been banging your head against a brick wall all these years, really, and you've got nowhere.
Well, who knows what would have happened, you know. But I did write a book which was serialised in the Daily Mail, which sold about 40,000 copies. So, you know, I don't know. I think arguably there is no democracy, there is no truth, and there's no point, you know. But then that's very pessimistic. We all have to live in hope. You can't expect one person. I mean, it wouldn't be a very democratic society if I could determine what everybody thought. It'd be as bad as if the Prime Minister could, you know. So you just have to plug away and leave it to other people to decide.
If you could just
think
pick out three or four points from the book,
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I know what you're going to ask. You're going to say, when did I first think... Because I always get asked this on radio programmes. When did I first get suspicious? And like Martin, it was really actually on day one, when I heard that a passport had been found from one of the alleged hijackers. And I just thought, that can't be quite right, you know, with everything going on in New York this today, you know, with paper and rubbish and dust and ashes, you know, 6 inches deep on the pavement. They're telling us that somebody found a passport, the passport survived the air crash, fluttered down to the ground, was found by somebody, and then the police had time to look at this lost passport and identify it as one of the hijackers and put the news out on the mass media within a couple of hours.
Well, Martin, what do you make of this whole hijacker conundrum? Were there hijackers that actually hijacked the aircraft or not?
I think I agree with Ian that we should stick to what we can prove rather than speculate. But one of the things I first picked up on is that they admitted, and perhaps Ian can correct me if I'm wrong, that none of the alleged hijackers appeared on the passenger lists that were issued by the airlines.
Yes, that were issued by the airlines.
Yeah.
But later, documents purporting to be flight manifests were released, and it did appear that people of those name that they've given, they've identified.
Didn't some of them survive afterwards somehow? I mean,
that's another story that goes round, and it's quite likely, but actually you can't nail it down when you do the research?
Well, I understood that in the Daily Telegraph and the BBC, various people who were named as hijackers came forward. One was in it, said, well, actually, we are those people, and we're still alive, and here we are.
I think this must be a bit weird. Nobody's, if you cannot, you're announced find... to be a hijacker or a terrorist, yeah, and you're seeing it on television and saying, hang on, that's me.
You can't.
I didn't do that. I'm not dead.
The problem is that Saudis have a name. It's a bit like saying, oh, there's this hijacker called John Smith. And then a lot of other people getting up and saying, well, I'm John Smith and I'm not the hijacker. The issue is, if it's the ones with the photos, it gets very murky, Tony.
Let's just move to look at motive, 9/11 motive. Did the Saudis have a motive for it?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, their motive would have been just to do what the CIA, you know, ingratiate
themselves. So they didn't. They were just under orders.
Well, Prince Bandar, you know, was a very old and close friend of the Bush family, and Bush badly needed something.
Martin,
he was in terrible
trouble.
Is there
anything you can think of as a motive?
Well, Prince Turki bin Faisal, he was the head of Saudi Mukhabarat, the intelligence service, and he eventually became ambassador to Britain. And he was asked in a press conference that he gave what he knew about 9/11 and whether Saudi Arabia was involved. And what he said is, you'd better ask George Bush about that, is what he said.
Bringing all things up to date, I mean, we are supposed to be a news programme, that is sort of looking at the background. But one of the stories I saw this week was really pretty shocking by a chap called Chris Hedges on Truth Dig, was giving the bomb to Saudi Arabia's Dr. Strangelove, is the headline. The most dangerous thing, foreign policy decision of the Trump administration, and I know that's saying a lot, he says, is its decision to share sensitive nuclear technology with Saudi Arabia and authorise US companies to build nuclear reactors in the country. He spent several years in the Middle East, and I covered, he says, the despotic, repressive kingdom in the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I, along with most Arabists in the US, have little doubt that giving nuclear capability to Saudi Arabia under the leadership of ruthless and amoral Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would see it embark on a nuclear weapons program and eventually share weaponized technology with the Saudi allies and proxies that include an army of radical jihadists and mortal enemies of America. A nuclearized Saudi Arabia is a grave existential threat to the Middle East and ultimately to the United States. Now, you first, Martin, do you think there's any substance to what Chris is saying there? He's saying this is basically not being reported, but it's one of the most important decisions the Trump administration have made.
Well, the stuff I've been reading, which is only rumour, is that the Israelis have already provided them with nuclear weapons because they're very close allies with the Saudis these days. I don't know whether that's true.
They always were, but it's come up.
Yeah.
There's one of these many things which was a conspiracy theory, and now they've confirmed it, you know, that actually they are allies.
I mean, because they've got this idea that the Iranians got nuclear weapons and they've got to have them, or they're trying to get nuclear
weapons.
It's
about distracting the ordinary Arab public, isn't it?
According to Chris Hedges, this has been masterminded, this sharing of the nuclear technology with the Saudis, by a chap called Jared Kushner. Who is this guy?
That's the son-in-law of Bush.
He's
Trump, sorry. What am I talking about? He's basically an amateurish, you know, property dealer from New York, but he's now playing geopolitics. I think if the Saudis got nuclear weapons, Putin made a speech some while ago. He said, if anybody uses nuclear weapons on us or any of our allies, meaning potentially Iran, we will go for it. We will nuke whoever does that. So in other words, getting nuclear weapons doesn't get the Saudis very far, because they can't be used short of Armageddon, and therefore there's not much point having them, which is what the Iranians have concluded.
Well, when Kevin Cahill was on here a few weeks ago, he pointed out that the US has just authorised the manufacture of a new series of mini-nukes.
Yeah.
The point being that battlefield commanders can use these mini-nukes, and it's a way of getting from a conventional war into a nuclear war. So that's always been considered like a big red line that you don't cross if you're a military commander. But with a mini-nuke, you may be able to actually say, well, with a few of these things, maybe the other side will hit us back with a nuclear war, and then we can have what we want.
Well,
and I mean, the thing is, there's also, sorry to keep interrupting, I know you wanted to say something, Martin, but many people will say, well, nobody wants a nuclear war.
Well, that's true. I mean, what is the possible use of a mini nuke? The possible use
of make money for the manufacturers.
Well, it makes money for the manufacturers. It's just a boondoggle, yes. And of course, there's no. I can't see any conceivable. I mean, what Putin said when he, on major foreign policy speech, some months ago, he said,
if anybody uses nuclear weapons, even little ones, we stick by the strategic doctrine of the Russian general staff has been since World War II, we will go all out straight away, yeah? If you cross that line, we are going to give you the, you know, and he said, you know, we will go to heaven, but you will not even have time to pray before our missiles take you out. And therefore, they're going back to the old strategic doctrine. You use nuclear weapons, we are going to destroy you. And of course, at that point, they're not actually usable. Unless you're really going to go for it. The idea that they will use a mini nuke on Iran, for example, and that the Russians will just sit back and say, oh, we're not going to do anything about that, or use a mini nuke, or just keep it at mini nuke level, that's not going to work.
It's called the W76-2, this wonderful new device that the Americans have produced. And the context of this, Martin, of course, is that they've just pulled out, the US has just pulled out of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty with the Soviet Union.
Russia. But yes, it was signed with the Soviets,
but yeah, the context of this really being that the Americans, if they're going to have a fight with the Russians, that there's not a lot of support for that, for example, in Germany.
There isn't, but the Germans basically do as they're told. They're basically a vassal state of the US. I think you may disagree, Ian, because you've got a German wife. But I mean, in Germany, they don't. They're going to build the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, though. It's 70% completed. The Americans don't want them to build it, but it's being built. And by the end of this year, it'll be running.
The indication is the Germans didn't want to go into Syria, for example. They've had a big fight over Volkswagen as a result of that. What's your view on the extent to which Berlin is actually independent of what they're being told from Washington?
Very difficult question, complex, of course. I think basically in Germany, the Christian Democrats, who are the Conservative Party, are pro-American, and the Social Democrats aren't so pro-American. And so Nord Stream, you know, was basically authorised by the Schröder government, so I think you find when you look into it. Merkel, I mean, the thing of the I think there's a very sinister and deceptive relationship between Germany and America, because we'd all like to think that there's a good guy around somewhere. So it's the good guy, bad guy technique. And if you particularly look at Ukraine, in my opinion, Germany was very much of a major force behind the takeover of Ukraine by the far right, you know, which they described as a revolution, but was actually a coup. And I was reading German foreign policy documents in the 1990s, and it was very clear that they felt that they had a right to Ukraine, and now they've got it, basically, and got it in the EU, more or less.
Okay, well, it's not going to be in the EU. I think that's fanciful.
This relationship between the EU and Britain post-Brexit and what foreign policy might look like was also looked at by Stephen Sacker from the BBC in his conversation with Lord Ricketts. And so let's have a listen to that now. It's quite a fascinating conversation, really, with Lord Ricketts, the top civil servant and a national security advisor to David Cameron, saying that the picture was rather bleak, although he's not the only person who has knowledge in this field. And so Stephen Sacker put some of those opposite views to him.
You've also zeroed in on national security, and you bring to this a lot of experience because you were indeed David Cameron's national security advisor for a couple of years in his premiership. You and others, including John Sawyers, former head of MI6, have contended that the Brexit will do real, lasting, serious damage to Britain's national security and its sort of geopolitical standing in the wider world. Explain that to me.
Well, let's start with Britain's law and order, the cooperation that goes on between our police forces, those on the continent, our judicial authorities and those on the continent. I sit on a House of Lords committee which has looked at that and which has put out a report saying that we believe there are real risks for our security of leaving the EU without tying down a continuation of the cooperation that goes on under the EU instruments. At the moment, our police forces depend on databases, on confidential messaging systems, on a whole range of instruments to cooperate across borders with their European counterparts. We can only be part of those as a member of the EU. When we leave, we'll have to negotiate some sort of associate status.
We'll have to negotiate another status, another association. And given the import that everybody in Europe puts upon cooperation with Britain because of its very impressive record in a whole raft of different security agencies, there is almost no likelihood at all that Europe won't want very close security cooperation with the United Kingdom.
Well, what they say is that there are rules about who can be part of these EU instruments, and when you're a third country outside, you have to negotiate an associate status. Mm. It will give you less good access. And in some areas, like the European arrest warrant, some countries won't be willing to extradite their citizens to the UK at all. In others, there are EU instruments, but no country outside the EU is even an associate. So it's a complex field. It's going to take years of negotiation. And if we go ahead and leave before that's tied down, our law enforcement authorities will find it less easy to work. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner herself has said the same thing, so I'm far from being alone here. I think it's worth highlighting this.
Yeah, no question you're not alone, but it comes back to the same thing about subjectivity and whether you bring a glass half full or a glass half empty approach to Brexit. Let me quote to you a couple of senior security figures who do not take the same view as you. Jeremy Fleming, GCHQ director. In 2018, at a NATO conference, he said, "We are leaving the EU, but we're not leaving Europe. We have excellent relationships with intelligence and security agencies right across this continent. We expect them to continue." Richard Dearlove, a former head of MI6, very sanguine about Britain's ability to develop strong relationships with the Europeans after Brexit. So, again, it's a pick and mix. You can hear what you want to hear on both sides of this debate.
No, well, let's unpack that. Jeremy Fleming is talking about intelligence relationships, and I completely agree with him. Intelligence relationships happen outside the EU now. They will go on happening outside the EU afterwards. So they are not a part of this argument. Law enforcement, judicial cooperation, foreign policy cooperation, defence cooperation go through the EU and will be affected.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but if I may say so, it seems to me the biggest British foreign policy, security, military decision of the past 20 years, the one of most significance, was the decision to join the Americans in the invasion of Iraq, toppling Saddam Hussein. Now, when that happened, the EU was adamantly opposed to that policy. It was Britain, the United States, a few other EU member states like Spain and Poland who supported that. But the EU as a whole, led by Jacques Chirac of France, was absolutely opposed to it. So when it comes to those key elements of Britain's national security policy, it's not the EU that matters most. It's our relationship with the United States and it's NATO.
Well, the EU was absolutely split down the middle. It wasn't opposed, it was split on Iraq, with some countries taking one position, other countries...
The Franco-German motor, which is still at the centre of the European Union, thought that our decision to go into Iraq was mad.
Correct, yeah. And then a lot of people would agree with them that that was a good judgment.
So when you tell me that, if we leave the EU, our security, our military, our defence capabilities will be fatally undermined, it seems to me categorically to fly in the face of history and the evidence.
But I haven't said our defence capabilities will be undermined. I've said in a very clear way the internal security issues of law and order and judicial cooperation will be affected. They won't stop altogether, but the police will find it harder, slower, to take more resources to achieve the cooperation that we have now. On intelligence, it won't be affected. On defence, much less, because defence, EU has a defence capacity, but it's a very modest one. The main load goes through NATO and in our bilateral relationship with America.
Indeed.
And I've never argued otherwise.
And isn't the truth, and you would know this much better than me as a former ambassador to France, that even the French still want very strong defence and military cooperation with Britain, whatever happens about Brexit?
They do, although if you notice, now on the defence industrial side, where we had very close cooperation with the French, for example, between BAE and Dassault over future aircraft and drones, now suddenly all that is orienting towards France and Germany. So on the industrial side, it's more difficult. But just to finish on that point, I think Britain's weight in the world will be less as a result of leaving the EU.
That's the former Mandarin, civil servant in charge of the Foreign Office and a whole load of other things, ambassador to France, ambassador to NATO, national security advisor to David Cameron. He's Lord Peter Ricketts speaking to Stephen Sacker earlier this week.
I don't want to see Brexit, but I don't find that kind of argument at all convincing. As we all know, we've just been talking about 9/11, but the NATO, the CIA, that is what really happens. The EU is essentially a vassal state of the US, and that's the reality. And
in a sense, all of this stuff about not having cooperation. The German state is dominated by the Americans. And that's why we had a war in Ukraine. And as I mentioned earlier, when Britain went to war in Iraq, France and Germany voted against in the Security Council, or abstained. And in actual fact, we'd have been better to listen to them than we did to the Americans. And of course, if we leave the EU, it'll be the Americans telling us what to do, as they do now.
And it was, of course, an illegal invasion. Let's also look at the clashes in Kashmir, because Robert Fisk has published an article this week saying Israel's playing a big role in India's escalating conflict with Pakistan. Signing up to the war on terror, especially Islamist terror, may seem natural for two states built on colonial partition whose security is threatened by Muslim neighbours, he says. When I first heard the first news report, I assumed it was the Israeli air raid on Gaza or Syria. When you heard the news reports of the air raid on Pakistan, airstrikes on a terrorist camp were the first words. Command and control centre destroyed. An Islamist jihadi base had been eliminated. Then I heard the name Balakot and realised that it was neither in Gaza or Syria or even Lebanon, but in Pakistan. How can anyone mix up Israel and India? Well, don't let the idea fade away. 2,500 miles separate the Israeli Ministry of Defence in Tel Aviv from the Indian Ministry of Defence in New Delhi. There's a reason why the usual cliché-stricken agency dispatches sound so similar. For months, Israel has been assiduously lining itself up alongside India's nationalist BJP government in an unspoken and politically dangerous anti-Islamic coalition, as Islamist coalition, an unofficial, unacknowledged alliance, while India itself has now become the largest weapons market for the Israeli arms trade, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the BJP in India and Likud and people to the right of Likud in Israel have always had a very strong relationship. And, they see, the Islamic other as their enemy. And, of course, the ordinary people in Kashmir and in Palestine see them as the enemy. And, of course, we're still a long way from any peaceful solution to either of those conflicts.
What about the so-called perpetrators of this sort of inflaming of tensions between India and Pakistan? Jaish al-Mohammed, the terrorists inside Pakistan. What do we know about them?
Well, as I understand it, that particular group has been banned inside Pakistan, which is what Imran Khan said, that we banned this group. So you can't say that we did it, but of course there may be elements within the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency or the army that may have been helping them. But in a sense, it was a suicide bomber, and he killed about 40 Indian soldiers. Now, if you're going to have a war, that's about as clean a hit as you're going to get. Of course, the Indians didn't like it, but then they're not prepared to negotiate about Kashmir. And the whole question of whether Kashmir should be part of India is a serious one, because there was supposed to be a referendum, which has never taken place, because the Maharaja of Kashmir was a Hindu, and he decided that he was going to put Kashmir as part of India. And that in theory, there was going to be a referendum. There never was. So the creation of India, it was about the same time as the creation of Israel, was done on the basis of blood and iron. You know,
reading,
and we're still living the consequences.
Reading in the Daily Express today, the Indian election latest, the Indian PM Modi's support is soaring with his hard man. He's now supposedly got a tough stance against Pakistan, and he's doing really well in the polls.
Yeah, and if you read Arundhati Roy, who was a novelist but has now become a very, a reportageur, if you like, she is very good at pointing out the role of the research and analysis wing of the Indian Army in stirring sectarian tensions within India and elsewhere as a means of political control. I mean, Modi, they brought in, tried to get rid of all cash in the Indian economy, which caused huge problems for poor people, made them very unpopular. But now, of course, they're banging the drum for war with Pakistan, and Modi's opinion poll ratings are
headlines in the Jerusalem Post this week. Jeremy Corbyn calls on the UK to freeze arms sales to Israel after UN Gaza report. The report focuses primarily on Israeli and not Hamas violence and concluded that the protests were peaceful despite the hundreds of people that were shot dead.
Well, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has taken the right line on this, as he's taken the right line on stopping arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
It's not just the sort of the line. I think you'll probably find it's a legal obligation.
It is.
Somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
They're not supposed to sell arms to people who
That's
are using
right.
them to kill civilians with, and taking pot shots, killing children. It's terrible.
Well, we were hearing earlier on in the first hour about anti-Semitism, but there's also a film coming out called Witch Hunt by Jackie Walker, who was removed from the Labour Party, Martin. She was the deputy head of Momentum for pointing out that some Jews were involved in the slave trade. Now, that was misrepresented by many media organisations to say that she was trying to say that the Jews were behind the slave trade. Well, she never actually said that, and she had no intention of saying it, as far as I can see. And so I spoke to Jackie earlier this week to see what she makes of this latest removal of Chris Williamson, the Labour MP, and suspension of him from the party.
Well, I mean, she is herself Jewish, and lots of people like Tony Greenstein and others are being accused of being anti-Semitic, even though they are in fact Jews. And we had a Jewish Voice for Labour had a meeting in Bristol, which I went along to, and one of the founders of it, I can't remember her name, said, well, I didn't really want to found a separate Jewish group. You know, I'm a doctor and I wanted to support the NHS and so on. But if other people are going to start speaking in my name, saying Jews think this and Jews think that, then I'm going to speak out. And Jewish Voice for Labour have been very, very commendable in turning around to other people and saying, look, you can't speak for us. You're not speaking for
one
us.
One of the things Jackie says is that Chris Williamson wasn't actually suspended for his comments about Labour's approach to anti-Semitism, but because he was organising a screening of her film in the House of Commons.
If you look at what's just happened this week, let's take it. A Labour MP is basically suspended from the party because he wanted to put a film on by a Jewish organisation, a pro-Corbyn Jewish organisation. A pro-Corbyn Labour councillor, because she tells a joke that's very common amongst Jews, a pun on the word Jew, is suspended from the Labour Party. I've just heard today that there have been people who are candidates for council, candidates for parliament, who are being phoned up and told, literally, that if they go and see the film, they will have their candidacy reversed. I mean, if you don't call that a witch hunt, I don't know what it is.
So why is it so controversial, this film, do you think, Jackie? Why are people saying it is?
Well, the people who are saying it's controversial have not seen the film. So how would they know it's controversial? That's number one. I think it's controversial because we're supposed to accept a particular narrative. And that narrative is the one, for example, that we heard Margaret Hodge talk about on Radio 4 three times yesterday morning. Margaret Hodge on the radio talking about the leader of her party, talking about the Labour Party as being a kind of rabid anti-Semite party. The issue now is, just like with Chris Williamson, you can apparently, the only way that you don't get victimised is to accuse your own party of being racist. If you say that that is not true, then you're accused of being anti-Semitic. And I have to point out that, as far as I can see, the chief victims of this at the moment are Jews. What we're talking about here, you see, is not about anti-Semitism. This is about whether you support Jeremy Corbyn or not. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was 2 days ago, a Labour MP stood up in an interview and basically said to be anti-capitalist was to be anti-Semitic, i.e. capitalism is so close to Jewish identity that to criticise capitalism is to be anti-Semitic. Now, can you imagine? That's an outrageously racist thing to say. That's exactly the kind of thing the Nazis said. Now, why hasn't she been suspended from the party? The reason is that she's a critic of Corbyn.
Well, in actual fact, at the Labour Party conference, there was going to be a screening of the film, and somebody phoned in a bomb threat, and it was cancelled, and nobody's been caught for that. But they should be, and if you find out who called in that bomb threat, you might find it leads back to the Israeli embassy.
There's also, yes, there's the lobby, isn't there? An Al Jazeera film all about that. But anyway, time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon on BCFM. You'll find this show's podcast at This Week. oneword.org.uk and a load of links to the stories from tonight. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Martin Summers will be back again next week, we hope. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. Thanks for Ian Henshaw, our guests, and all the rest of them. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
Once you start breaking all of these little rules, all these things that had been done a certain way, and now you're going to ignore that.
Setting new precedents.
Yeah, ignore it. Yeah, and you're going to set precedents that can be then followed by people who come later and who will then take it even further. And there's a snowball effect to all of this where there was nothing immediately there was no immediate existential threat to the Republic, but the accumulation of this over the years and decades does roll you all the way eventually to Julius Caesar.
A conversation on the end of the Republic in Rome. Our guest is Mike Duncan. He is the author of the book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic.
Tiberius retaliates and he says, okay, well, you're going to veto my bill. Well, I'm going to veto every bill, right? Now we're just going to shut down the government, right? It's like, when we've seen, and like you say, I mean, this is not anything. I'm telling you, this is Plutarch, you know, this is Plutarch and Appian. This is not something out of the New York Times, but it could be.
Mike Duncan is a popular podcaster. He works on such shows as The History of Rome and his current project, Revolutions. Mike Duncan joins us next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House will vote on a resolution condemning anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and other forms of hate. Pelosi said the measure won't name Ilhan Omar, the freshman Democrat whose comments to get about Israel sparked the resolution. Pelosi defended Omar against the charge of anti-Semitism.
I don't think that that the Congresswoman is perhaps appreciate the full weight of how it was heard by other people, although I don't believe it was intended in any anti-Semitic way. We're working now on a resolution that will, again, speak out against anti-Semitism, anti-Islamophobia, anti-white supremacy in all the forms that it takes, that our country has no place for this.
The latest uproar flared after Omar last week criticized what he called, quote, the political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. It was a reference to Israel. After being attacked over her comment, Omar tweeted, quote, I have not mischaracterized our relationship with Israel. I have questioned it, and that has been clear from my end. At a contentious closed-door meeting yesterday with Democratic Party lawmakers, freshman members of the caucus confronted Pelosi and other leaders over the push to rebuke Omar, saying she is being singled out. Trump administration officials said there are no U.S. plans to intervene militarily in the crisis in Venezuela. That's despite the fact that President Trump and others repeatedly have said all options are on the table to support the ouster of President Nicolas Maduro. The special U.S. envoy for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, answered a question posed by New Hampshire Democrat Gene Shaheen to Abrams and Agency for International Development Director Mark Green.
Are you, either of you, aware of any plans within the administration for any military action in Venezuela, Mr. Abrams?
No, not in the sense you mean it. I mean, there are always contingency plans. I don't know how much to get into this in an open hearing, but, for example, for the protection of every single U.S. embassy around the world, there are always such plans. But we are not pursuing that path.
It wasn't clear whether lawmakers believe Abrams. He pled guilty in 1991 to two counts of lying to Congress about what he knew of the Reagan administration's illegal efforts to send arms and other supplies to Nicaraguan Contra rebels fighting to overthrow the country's elected government in the early 1980s. Abrams was a chief backer of the so-called Nicaraguan Contra War. A fired Florida police officer was found guilty of manslaughter and attempted murder for the fatal 2015 shooting of a stranded black motorist. Newman Raja is the first Florida police officer to be convicted of an on-duty shooting in 30 years. He now faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years and could spend his life in prison for the death of 31-year-old Corey Jones. Prosecutors said Raja escalated what should have been a routine interaction into a deadly confrontation. Working in plain clothes, he drove his unmarked van the wrong way up an off-ramp, stopping feet from Jones' broken-down SUV at 3 in the morning. The prosecutor said Raja never identified himself and acted so aggressively, Jones must have thought he was about to be carjacked or killed. That caused Jones, who was a concealed weapons permit holder, to grab his gun and run as Raja repeatedly opened fire. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort is expected to learn how much time he'll serve in prison for tax and bank fraud. Manafort appears in Virginia federal court this afternoon. He could receive a 20-year prison term. Manafort was convicted in a jury trial of hiding from the IRS millions of dollars he earned from his work advising Ukrainian politicians. A big unknown is whether President Trump will pardon him. Trump refused to rule out a presidential pardon in an interview last November. That might not spare Manafort jail time, though. The Manhattan District Attorney is pursuing charges against Manafort as well. And Tennessee is the latest state to take action on a bill that would ban abortion once a fetal heartbeat is detected. That's about 6 weeks into pregnancy when many women don't even know they're pregnant. The Tennessee House approved the legislation, sending it to the Senate. The Republican governor said he'll sign it. The ACLU said it would sue. Similar bills are being considered in several other states. Conservatives want to push such a case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court to help overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we're going to be in conversation about the fall of the Roman Republic, a fascinating story which may, especially if you're following the news today, could be quite interesting to look back and try to find some of those parallels. Joining me here in the studio is Mike Duncan. Now, Mike Duncan is a renowned history podcaster. He hosted the award-winning History of Rome podcast, and he is now currently producing another popular podcast, which is called Revolutions, and it is a series of podcasts about major historic revolutions in history. He is the author of the new book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. Mike Duncan, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to the station.
Thank you for having me. this is a conversation I'm very much looking forward to have. It's a fascinating one. And let's first talk about the period we are talking about. When we say the fall of the Roman Republic, probably important to note, the fall of the Roman Republic is quite different than the fall of the Roman Empire.
The fall of the Roman Republic is very different from the fall of the Roman Empire, and I thank you for getting it right, because it is something that you run into where you're like, oh, you're talking about the fall of the Roman Empire. It's like, no, the fall of the Roman Empire happens, around about 500 AD. You know, the period of my book is 146 BC, so it's 650 years earlier. That's quite a stretch of time difference there. And, you know, Julius Caesar is operating when the Republic does finally fall. You know, the storm that is my book is the storm before the storm. The actual storm that I'm obviously referring to is, you know, when Caesar comes along and Pompey and Octavian and Mark Antony, that's all in the 30s and 40s BC. So when it's a changeover, it's a massive transition that Roman civilization goes through, where for 500 years they had been governed by this, you know, a cooperative government, shared leadership, shared responsibilities. You know, one man could not be consul for more than a year. There were always two consuls every year. There were popular assemblies. There was voting. There was a lot of participatory aspects to their government, which collapse in a series of gigantic civil wars that everybody, you know, has some understanding of, just because, you know, Julius Caesar is all wrapped up in this and he's a pretty well-known historical figure. Well, once the Republic collapses, the empire does go on for 500 more years. Yes. And Roman civilization continues to flourish. It's just what was lost was all of those participatory aspects, where it's now the government of Rome is an autocratic military dictatorship. I mean, there's no real other way to describe it. And so that's what happens. So the period of my book here is about 100 years. It begins about 100 years before the fall of the Republic, to start talking about, you know, what was it that started going wrong for the Republic, that it had persisted for 350, 400 years, and then sort of over the course of about a century, it disintegrated and collapsed in a bloody heap. So what was it that started that process? We all know the end of the story. So, like, let's talk about what the beginning of the story. How did it begin? And as you said, you know, like, if there are any sorts of, like, interesting parallels that you want to draw, like, if we're sitting at the beginning of something, it would be nice to avoid what happened to the Romans. Because it is quite a bloody heap that it winds up at.
Tell me about Rome in 146 BC. And tell me about it in its place in the world. This is when we see the expansion.
Right. So Rome, you know, Rome begins its life as just another little city-state in Italy. You know, there's plenty, it's, you know, dotting all over there, just another little city-state. And over the course of hundreds of years, they slowly begin to expand. They start to, you know, acquire territory in Italy. They're moving into northern Italy. Then they're moving into southern Italy. And this ultimately brings them into conflict with the Carthaginians, which is this, like, rival empire that's based out of North Africa. And this is where, you know, if you know a little bit about Roman history, this is the war that Hannibal is going to be figure so prominently in.
And the elephants. Everybody
knows that Hannibal, like, what do you know about Hannibal? Hannibal had elephants. How do you know that Hannibal had elephants? I don't know. I think I read it in The Far Side. Like, that's why people know about Hannibal and the elephants. But so they wind up in this sort of, like, century long struggle with Carthage, really for control.
And Carthage is the power at the time, isn't it, in the Mediterranean?
They're about equal. That's the thing. It was really a struggle between, I would say, two powers that were able to draw on about the same amount of wealth and resources and manpower. And the Romans, just over the course of about a century, got the upper hand, defeated the Carthaginians. And then where my book begins is 146 BC. And what's happened is that as a result of these Punic Wars, this long-term struggle, Rome is by far now the strongest power in the Mediterranean world.
From sort of a bipolar power struggle to a
unipolar. And so Rome, you know, at this point, they control Spain, they control Greece, they control, you know, chunks of North Africa. They have not yet expanded to Egypt and to Syria and well into the Eastern Mediterranean, but there's nobody out there who's going to be able to stop them. So once Rome makes the decision to go over to Egypt, which is really a story of, like, when they run into Cleopatra, that whole story, which happens after the course of my book, There's nobody that can stop them. They're quite simply the strongest power in the Mediterranean world. And then they will hold that distinction for, you know, the next 500, 600 years.
If Samuel Huntington was around during this time, you might call it the end of history.
Yeah, it was the end of history, yes. Well, I mean, they do wind up...
Isn't that what Polybius kind of suggested that, didn't he? A historian of this period.
Well, I mean, Polybius certainly believes that there's nothing that's going to be able to stop the Romans from taking over and that everybody better get used to the idea. I mean, he wrote a very influential history of the Roman Republic that we still use today. I mean, I drew on it heavily for the book because you can always draw on Polybius. He's a wonderful guy who writes wonderful things.
Easy read?
Not really. None of it's very easy. But I enjoy it.
I tried, but I couldn't.
Yeah, no, it. I mean, it's really great. Polybius is a really subtle thinker and historian, and I like him quite a bit. But he was definitely – he wrote that to explain to the Greeks that, you know, our time is over. And it's the Romans. It's a Roman world now, and we live in it, and we need to adjust to that. Right when Polybius is writing this – is right when the aristocratic element of the state, the Senate, begins to take on more power and more authority than they previously had. And they did start to crowd out the democratic element. And they even crowded out the executive element because the consuls were just drawn from the ranks of the Senate. So there was really no conflict ever between the consuls and the Senate. And the Senate started co-opting the democratic aspects of the system. And so by when the 140s and 130s are coming along, like when actually Polybius is writing all of this, it all makes sense in theory. But in practice, the aristocratic element has already started to expand to the point where it's going to create that democratic populist reaction that, you know, Aristotle had correctly identified as something that might happen.
Yeah. So then tell me about the situation at home in Rome that would feed this democratic or even a populist feel that's going on. What are the conditions? Again, Rome's at its highest point. You've defeated Carthage. You've taken over a bunch of Greek areas and then also Spain too.
Yeah, Spain. They conquered the Spanish too.
So what's happening at home then during this period?
So as a result of this military conquest, this military and political conquest, you have the wealth of the Mediterranean world is now pouring into Italy and pouring specifically into Rome. So this is wealth on an almost unimaginable scale that is pouring into Rome over the course of just a few generations. So you have there is this skyrocketing economic equality. If we were going to use today's terms to describe it, you would say there's skyrocketing economic inequality because those senatorial leaders, that senatorial element that was gaining more and more power, they were the generals. They were the consuls. They were the people who were in charge of the disbursement of those funds. They were in control of the state treasury, which is where all of this stuff was being deposited. So this very small clique of senatorial families just have so much money now, and it's insane. So the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, but why are they getting poorer? It's because when they were being hauled off to fight in these same wars, they're the privates, they're the sergeants, the centurions of the Roman armies. They're getting hauled off to fight in these battles and these wars that go on for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years at a stretch. In a way that when they were just fighting at home, when they were fighting Italian campaigns in the early days of the Republic. You'd go, you'd fight for a couple months, and then like, oh, it's harvest time. Let's everybody break, right? Because everybody on both sides is living a fundamentally agrarian lifestyle. So it's like, oh, God, it's harvest time for you. It's harvest time for me. Let's call a truce. We'll go back. We'll harvest our crops. And then then we'll come back and we'll figure it out. And if we can't get it straightened away by October, we'll just, take the winter off and pick it up where we left off. Well, this stops happening. And you stop being able to come home and harvest your crops and come home and take care of your little small plot of land. So these guys are coming back from 5-6 years on campaign, and their little small farms are ruined. So they can't keep up with their richer neighbors. They don't have the resources themselves to bring their little plots of land back up to its productive level. And so they start getting bought out by all those richer families.
Rich people.
Yeah, they're like – so the rich guys are sitting there with these piles of gold. And in Roman civilization, land is the true measure of wealth, not gold coins. So they're like, well, I'll give you some of my gold and you give me your plot of land and now we have a nice transaction. And that really leads to over the course of decades and then about 100 years, just the complete dispossession of most of the smallhold farmers. The citizen farmer that had been the backbone of the Roman Republic is basically just going to be eradicated by this process of economic inequality. And that creates, man, the resentful energy that is going to fuel this, you know, to get back to the, you know, the final kicker of this, is that's going to fuel this populist reaction to what the aristocracy is doing.
All right, let's get into two important figures, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus. They're brothers. Tell me about them.
Well, yeah, so Tiberius is 10 years older than Gaius, and Tiberius comes along first. And, you know, everything that I was just talking about with this, you know, with the economic inequality that is beginning to, it's beginning to become a real problem. And lots of, I mean, the Gracchi are not like lower born rabble rousers or anything. Right. Like they're inner circle Roman nobility. But a lot of these guys can see that there's, you know, this dislocation, the social and economic and political dislocation that's going on, that, you know, you got Roman citizens that are truly losing any kind of sense of dignity that they once had. It's becoming more difficult to recruit for the legions. There's a lot of problems that are brewing that could be solved if they were able to replenish the supply of citizen farmers who just own a plot of land that they work. And now you're sort of restoring, you're bringing back. It's weird. The Gracchi are considered to be very radical innovators, but in this one particular way, it's a very conservative thing that they're trying to do. They are trying to recreate things as they had been before things started to change. But the only way you can do it is by just going to the rich and taking their land and redistributing it to the poor. And that's what the Lex Agrarii was going to do.
And this is about public land, right?
Right, sure. Yeah. Very, very specifically, there was publicly owned land. There was Ager Publicus that the Roman state owned. Nobody actually did own it, but you could lease it to an individual. But there was a law on the books that said that, you know, to take the take the equivalent measurements was about 300 acres, that a family could not control or lease more than 300 acres of public land. But over the decades, you know, those rules had just been completely ignored, because the only people who were going to enforce the rules were themselves, like, had way more public land than they were ever supposed to own. So it's like, let's all just get away with this together. So they were all getting away with it together. And what the Lex Agraria proposed to do was to enforce those laws. And if they went through, I mean, we're talking about, like, yeah, we're going to hire land surveyors, we're going to hire clerks, we're going to hire mules and have guys go out there and go through deed records. And if you are controlling more than 300 acres of public land, then we're going to strip you of the rest. We're going to divvy it up into small plots, and we're going to give it to, you know, the dispossessed poor citizens of Rome. So this is the big project that Tiberius Gracchus is trying to introduce. And, you know, by the end of chapter one, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but spoiler alert, Tiberius Gracchus is going to wind up dead. He's going to be beaten to death in an attempt to prevent him really from moving forward with these reforms. And then his attempt to run for re-election as a tribune, which is like the big breaking point in the story of Tiberius.
Right. And they're doing everything even before he's killed.
Right.
And that's an important moment. But even before that moment, I mean, again, there's just all these procedures that are happening in the Senate that they're trying to stop a vote, trying to stop him from speaking. Again, I'm reading this as I'm watching the Senate debate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, these little things, like,
I mean, it was real.
Yeah. There's a moment where, I mean, so Tiberius knows that this is not going to be a very popular bill. And the way it had always been done is a tribune was supposed to take a bill to the Senate, have the Senate comment on it. Well, he knows the Senate's going to say, we disapprove of this. So he says, I'll just take it directly to the people. This kind of gets the Senate on edge, and they more or less hire a tribune to veto the reading of the bill so that the bill can't even be read. And if the bill can't be read, then it can't come to a vote. Right? This had never – there was nothing illegal about this, but it is certainly nothing that had ever been done before. So Tiberius retaliates, and he says, okay, well, you're going to veto my bill. Well, I'm going to veto every bill, right? Now we're just going to shut down the government, right? It's like, when we've seen, and like you say, I mean, this is not anything. I'm telling you, this is Plutarch. You know, this is Plutarch and Appian. This is not something out of the New York Times, but it could be, in the sense that this leads to literally a shutdown of the government for a little while. And then the tribune in question continues to block the vote. And so Tiberius orders he asks the assembly, and they do it because they're all in his pocket, to depose that tribune from office. There's nothing illegal about that, but that had never been done before either. So they literally vote to remove that guy from power so that they can push forward with this vote. And yeah, I mean, there's these sorts of things when you read these things and you're just flipping through the ancient histories. And then, yeah, as you say, you go back to C-SPAN or you go back to what's going on CNN and you're like, wow, I see Mitch McConnell's not even allowing a hearing on a Supreme Court nominee. Like,
yeah.
These are the kinds of things that I do think that there are parallels that one. And then, you know, one of the big theories of the book before we get, you know, too far on down this is once you start breaking all of these little rules, all these things that had been done a certain way, and now you're going to ignore that.
Setting new precedents.
Yeah, ignore it. Yeah, and you're going to set precedents that can be then followed by people who come later and who will then take it even further. And there's a snowball effect to all of this where there was nothing immediately there was no immediate existential threat to the Republic, but the accumulation of this over the years and decades does roll you all the way eventually to Julius Caesar.
This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we are in conversation with podcaster Mike Duncan. He hosts a very popular podcast on history. His first series of podcasts, and there are many of them, was about the history of Rome, and the second is on the history of global revolutions. He is the author of the book The Storm Before the Storm, which lays out the fight between the haves and the have-nots that would tear the Roman Republic apart over about a 100-year period. We're going to dive further into Tiberius Gracchus and his brother in just a moment. The Soviet Union, I at least have heard, called Tiberius the first communist revolutionary. It's interesting, this issue over land that Mike Duncan is talking about. Last night, I was reading a little bit about the debates on the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And the main architect of the Constitution, James Madison, wanted and worried, actually, that this republic would be imperiled once all the land was settled. And when we say land was settled, we mean stolen and murdered for, of course, from the previous inhabitants. He thought that as long as there was enough land for white males to own, that the republic would be secure. But once land became scarce and owned by just a few, that society would then be divided into landowners and landless. Landless meaning that they didn't own the land. And that the landless, well, that they would become the majority. And when that happened, they would become an angry mob and tear apart the current republic that was designed, and James Madison had this very much in the front of his mind, to be run by the aristocrats. So interesting things to think about when we think about our own situation right now. Of course, all the land is quote unquote settled today. My friends, today is the last day that this radio program will be coming to you asking for a financial contribution in our winter 2019 fund drive. Coming in right now, and as I've told you before, we need to average $3,000 in order for us to be able to continue to do this format of a radio program during the fund drives, hopefully bringing you an interesting conversation that is educational, a story that might take you away for a little while and get lost in, and something that I hope is valuable of your time. At this very moment, we're averaging a little over $2,500 per hour. And for us to be able to actually get to that $3,000 average where we need to be able to do to justify this model, we need to raise $4,500 today. And the way I'm going to do it is the way that I always do it. I'm going to ask you for that contribution that you can afford, that is reasonable for you, one that is according to your own means. I have a couple of thank you gifts here in a moment. But again, the best way that you can help your radio station, as we're here at the end of this fund drive, and as a station, we're pretty far behind, the best way you can help this radio station is through what I like to call a pure donation. You are donating to support having this on the air and free and available to everyone, and understanding that if there aren't people that live
deliberately and support the things that they want to continue to have in their community, that they go away for everyone. So the phone number, and we are broadcasting both live on KPFA in Berkeley in Northern California and KPFK in Southern California, a different phone number for each station. So first, let me tell you about KPFA's phone number. That it is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, our phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. If you are interested in thank you gifts, we have them. This book that we are in conversation about, and it's a good read, and it gives you this story about Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus and the struggle over land and all these dynamics, is yours for a pledge of just $80, an $80 contribution to KPFA. We're going to send you a copy of this book. As we always do, we're offering the Letters on Politics Mondo Pack. So if you're interested in this interview, and in fact, you can get almost every historic interview that we have done over the years, more than 200 interviews on a USB drive that you plug into your computer. And in fact, you'll get another interview that we did not that long ago with Michael Klarman about how the Constitution was designed, as I was saying earlier, to ensure aristocratic rule. You get all those on a jump drive for a pledge of $180. So here's the phone number, 1-800-439-5732, if you are listening to KPFA. And I skipped something here because I was a little shocked by it. But we, on our last day, have a great pack. You can get the USB, the Letters on Politics Mondo collection, all of our history-related interviews, along with this book at the discounted rate of $200. I just saw that. I didn't believe it at first, but now I look at it again. It looks legit. So for a $200 pledge, it's like our last day end of the drive deal. $200 contribution, you get the book, The Storm Before the Storm, as well as this USB drive of all of our historic related interviews. So the number again, 1-800-439-5732. That's for KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. Okay, we now return to our conversation with Mike Duncan.
Tell me about the death of Tiberius Gracchus.
Well, Tiberius Gracchus was beaten to death by his enemies.
And is after their supporters?
Yeah,
and,
no. So what goes on is is that he manages to pass the Lex Agraria. They've begun the process of redistributing the land, but his term expires after 1 year. I mean, this is part of the bedrock of Republican political principle is you serve for a single year and then you retire. And Tiberius Gracchus proposes to run for re-election. This had never been done before.
He's trying to be a king.
Yeah, he's trying. Yeah, and they will
absolutely. They're anathema towards a king.
Right, of course.
Their founding mythology.
Exactly. So, yeah, he's accused of trying to make himself a king. And in the midst of the vote to re-elect him as tribune, basically a gang of senators led by the Pontifex Maximus himself, like conservative aristocratic senators and their retainers or their clients, mob into the election and just start cracking skulls. And one of the skulls that they crack is Tiberius Gracchus, and that's the end of him. That stops his reelection, and then they're able to sort of – it takes a little while to play out, but they are able to ultimately dry up the land redistribution, which had ultimately started all of this.
And then they threw his body in the Tiber River. You don't want to turn him into – they didn't want him to be turned into a martyr or a place where people – like a burial site where you can – kind of that they did Osama bin Laden, right? They dumped his body in the sea so that there wouldn't be this gathering spot for people to honor him.
Yeah, and very specifically in the moment, they did not want the funeral of Tiberius Gracchus to turn into a reigniting of the conflict, right? So these guys had been sort of jumped, right? Like Tiberius and his supporters had more or less been jumped by these conservative senators. And if you throw a funeral a couple days later, like maybe they're going to organize and be like, okay, well, you punched us. We're not going to come back to you. So yeah, they just sort of unceremoniously dumped them all in the Tiber River.
So Tiberius Gracchus is killed.
Mm-hmm.
But his reforms live on.
Yeah, the Lex Agraria, the land redistribution, is going to be arrested quite a bit after his death. The Senate's going to figure out a couple of things that they can do to put a stop to it. They're too detailed for us to go into here, but you can read it.
But basically what they did was they gave it a lack of enforcement, lack of funding. I mean, see this today.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, one of the big things that they tried to do it, but Tiberius got around it, was they said, okay, well, you can have your commission, you can have your land commission, but we're not going to vote you any money to do it. Now Tiberius is like, they got me there, but, you know, he stole a... But Tiberius's younger brother Gaius sort of picks up the baton, and he comes along a couple years later. He's now, you know, with his brother dead, he becomes the de facto head of this sort of political faction that Tiberius had helped organize. And Gaius is going to introduce, when he gets himself elected tribune a couple years later, he's going to introduce not just land redistribution, but he wants to build colonies. He wants to build roads. He wants you know, jobs for people out in the rural areas. Yeah, he wants, you know,
debt cancellation.
Caesar
or?
There was lots of debt. I mean, debt cancellation was a routine thing. I don't think debt cancellation was one of the parts of Gaius's program. But he is going to try to address in a massive way, in sort of a coordinated way, like many of these problems that were opening up as a result of Rome's great imperial triumph and all this inequality that is getting worse and driving people off their land. You have poor people in the cities who are suffering from food scarcity. And like, if one grain shipment doesn't come in, then like the whole city's going to explode in a famine, right? And he's like, well, I know how we can fix this. We'll subsidize the grain. And then, you know, that'll just be a smart thing that we do. So he's introducing all of these reforms. But it goes the same way for Gaius that it did for his brother. There's a conservative element inside the Senate that is going to resist this. They are going to they co-opt a lot of his measures. There's a tribune that comes in named Drusus the Elder, who becomes one of Gaius's fellow tribunes, and he says, you know, oh, Gaius is going to give you 4 colonies. Well, I'll give you 12 colonies. And oh, Gaius is going to give you a plot of land, but you have to pay property tax. Well, I'm going to give you a plot of land, but you won't have to pay property tax. And, you know, Gaius wants to give it not just to Roman citizens, but to Italians as well, like non-citizens, like just people in Italy. He wants to redistribute it to everybody. Well, I'll only give it to true Roman citizens. And this peels off a lot of support from Gaius. Mm. But Drusus never had any interest in following through with any of this. This was just a huge dust cloud that he was throwing up to be like, you know, they wanted to stop Gaius's reform. So how do you do it? You actually promise even greater reforms. And then once the people have turned to you and are like, all right, well, you say you're going to do even more for me. Well, I'll follow you. That allows the Senate to push Gaius to one side. He too, you know, will die a violent death. And then once Gaius is out of the picture, you know, where did those 12 colonies go? Where did the tax-free land go? Where did all of these promises wind up? Poof.
It was gone.
They're gone.
Yeah,
they were never followed through on. Because the point was not to solve problems. The point was to peel away support from Gaius long enough that they could dispose of him.
Looking at Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, or Gracchi, I guess if you say it together.
Just Gracchi?
Yes.
Gracchi?
Gracchi, I'm sorry. Yeah. Are they revolutionaries? You said on one hand earlier that there's even a conservative element to them of trying to get it the way things were before. But before this time, have you, for a serious student of history, have seen anything like this before that you saw with Tiberius and Gaius?
The answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
There were definitely examples of this type of program, populist. I mean, the populist demagogue was a fairly standard archetype in the ancient world, mostly in Greece, right? So, and you know, all the educated Romans at this point are, you know, they all read and speak Greek, right? And they've studied Greek history. And there was actually one of the books that I was reading about Tiberius Gracchus proposed that just before the arrival of the Gracchi that this treatise had been published about some of these Greek demagogues who had, you know, had done X, Y, and Z, and they promised land reform, and they wound up killing a bunch of people. Like, there's like real serious demagogues. I'm gonna rise up the people, and then we're gonna go murder the aristocracy of this city. And that idea was actually floating around inside the Senate, and then they were like watching Tiberius like try to do this same thing, and they're like, oh my god, he is gonna come murder us in our beds, even though I don't think that that's what Tiberius was up to. So there were examples of this kind of populist demagoguery that existed. But whether the Gracchi are revolutionaries, they're not trying to overthrow the government.
These are serious reformers?
They're very serious. They're reformers.
Yeah.
But they – both Tiberius and Gaius – and the other thing that's important to note is that they were tribunes, right, when this is happening.
That's
right. They're 30 years old. They're 32 years old. A tribunate is not the end goal of any Roman politician's career, right? You want to be consul. Consul's like the real prize. That's where you get when you're 40, 45 years old. So a lot of what Tiberius and Gaius were up to was a step along the way, on the way to their consulship, the consulship that they're ultimately going to be pursuing. They're growing their power base. They're using all these popular programs to make themselves more popular and more influential so that they could eventually run for consul. But they die as tribunes. So we think of them as if that was really – this was the end game for them. But it was not.
Right.
But I also don't believe that the end game was overthrowing the Senate and making themselves a tyrant. I don't believe that about Tiberius, and I don't believe it about Gaius. I believe that they wanted to be the most powerful and influential men in Rome, and I believe that they were willing to increase the power of other groups at the expense of the Senate, but not that they wanted to crash the system down on its head.
This conflict obviously would live beyond the deaths of both Tiberius and Gaius.
Yep.
Tell me what would happen. How do we get from this to Julius Caesar? Julius Caesar is the end of the Republic.
Right. He's the end of the end of the Roman Republic. And we're still at the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic. So those are the two bookends. I mean the Gracchi brothers and then Caesar and really like Octavian and Antony, you know, depending on where you want to put the pin in the like Schrodinger's cat box that is the Civil War. Like, when does the Republic die? Like, is it dead now? Like, this is a debate that you can have about like when it actually died. Is the cat alive or dead? Don't know. What happens to the Gracchi, their example and the memory of them continues to live on in the Republic. And the way that they harnessed powers outside of the elite conservative aristocracy, the powers that they were able to harness, people did see that and were able to try to emulate what it is that the Gracchi did and try to carry forward the legacy of the Gracchi, even if they themselves were dead. So there's about, Gaius dies at the end of the 120s. So the 110s, right, on your way on down. So it's hard to do like shorthand, like the 110s BC. Like, what does that
mean?
Okay, so it's the 110s BC. That's a conservative decade or so in Rome. I think that the Gracchan Populare coalition had been pretty well smashed. But it does come back. It does re-rise. They sort of put it off for 10 years, but it does sort of come back specifically. You know, if you get into the book, the corruption that is introduced by Jugurtha. Jugurtha is this North African king who wants to have his own way. He wants to sort of flout Roman authority. This is kind of offensive to the Roman people, but for some reason the Roman Senate isn't doing anything about it. Why isn't the Roman Senate doing anything about Jugurtha? And it's because Jugurtha is paying massive bribes to the Roman Senate to not get in his way, to not get into his business. So there's more or less a corruption scandal. I mean, a foreign power has more or less corrupted the Roman Senate, and this leads to a renewal of that populare energy. That gets taken over by a new generation of figures, and this then becomes sort of a cycle that does go on then for the next 100 years, where even if you get to a point where the Conservatives have once again like emerged victorious, which happens again like after about 100 BC. There's another little 10-year period where the energy of the populare had sort of spent itself in a pretty major battle inside of Rome. But this just kind of keeps coming back around. And Julius Caesar is himself uses this. You can back up and look at what Gaius Gracchus was doing and Tiberius Gracchus was doing and then fast forward to what Julius Caesar is doing.
Is he using their playbook?
Mostly. Yeah. And certainly he's using it, through Marius and through some other people. Because, I mean...
Marius was his uncle.
Of course. Marius is literally Julius Caesar's uncle, and Marius is one of these people who uses this kind of populare tactics. So there's kind of a direct line that gets passed down. And Julius Caesar's a populare leader, and he's going to use that. And he's going to be the one who ultimately does succeed in – and by Caesar's time, like – he's the same thing. Is he trying to overthrow the Senate? That was never really what he was trying to do. He wanted, not unlike the Gracchi, to be the most powerful man in Rome, the most influential man in Rome. But was he trying to destroy the Republic? Like, I don't think he was. Certainly that wasn't his aim to begin with. It just is what happened as a result of his pursuit, his insanely ambitious pursuit of power, his relentless pursuit of power. Does wind up destroying the Republic, but I don't think that's
so. Was it? Yeah, it wasn't Augustus Caesar.
So Julius Caesar
came after.
Yeah. He's Caesar's great nephew. So Julius Caesar introduces the death of the Republic, and then it's Octavian who then becomes Augustus. That guy is the one who puts the stamp on it, and it's dead and buried right by that point. But like I say, this is like a – between about 49 BC and 27 BC, you can sit down and make a case for about five or six different moments when you're like, and that's when the Republic died. Was it when Caesar crossed the Rubicon? Was it when he was assassinated? Was it when Antony Octavian won the Battle of Philippi? Is it when when Octavian defeated Antony? Where is the actual – line getting drawn.
This conversation about the end of the Roman Republic makes me think about our current moment. But that shouldn't be so surprising, because every time we talk about history, I am always thinking about the current moment. I don't fear Donald Trump ending the Republic. I don't think he has the support, actually, to be able to do it. You can't do it alone. You need a broad circle of support in order to do such a thing. Dictators don't rule alone. You need the military. You at least probably need another branch of government. Again, you just need a broad circle of support to be able to do something like that. And I don't think Donald Trump has that. But that doesn't mean that there aren't danger signs out there. And what I think about is what happens after Donald Trump. What happens after the precedents that are being set today? How do those play out down the road? And to be clear, they don't begin with Donald Trump, but they certainly are being enhanced. And one clear concern that I have is this declaration of a national emergency to build a wall on the southern border. Declaring a national emergency gives the president suddenly broad, incredible powers. And I wonder how that turns out in the long long road of history and building a precedent upon precedent. Friends, a quick fundraising update before we dive back into this conversation with Mike Duncan. This hour so far, we've raised $1,600. I'm incredibly thankful to the people who have called in with their support right now. Today is the last day that this radio program, Letters in Politics, will be asking you for a financial contribution here at the end of our 2019 fund drive. I mentioned earlier that if we are going to get to our overall $3,000 goal, that what I need to be able to do, meaning averaging $3,000 per day, we're actually going to have to raise $4,500 to do it. I don't know if that's possible, and that's okay. I mean, I get it. We're all doing the best we can. But right now we're off to a good start, and we have 15 more minutes to raise an additional $3,000 to do it. So here's the phone number. The best way you can help us out right now is what I like to call a pure donation. 1-800-439-5732. That's for KPFA in Northern California. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that phone number for KPFK is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. And again, we have some pretty awesome thank you gifts. This is, I love this book, actually. Mike Duncan's The Storm Before the Storm. Really, it's history. But it reads like a thriller. As you're going through these precedents upon precedents about what happened in the Roman Republic, offering it to you for a pledge of $80, your donation of $80, and we'll send you this book, The Storm Before the Storm. There's also the Letters on Politics Mondo Pack. If you like this interview, if you like all the interviews that we've done on history-related themes and topics, well, there's 200 of these interviews and interviews like this. About 120 hours worth of material on a USB drive that we will send you for a pledge of $180. And then we got a special pack for you. It's the end of the fun drive pack of Letters on Politics. You can get both the book, The Storm Before the Storm, which is going at an $80 pledge rate, and the Letters on Politics Mondo pack, which is going at a $180 rate for a discounted rate of $200. That's knocking $60 off the pledge rate. $200 pledge, you get both of them together. The number, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. That's for KPFA, where you can also pledge online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, it's 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. We now return to our conversation with Mike Duncan.
You know, looking at even ancient Greece and looking at the philosophers during this period and the historians, a lot of people were never enthusiastic about democracy, right? I mean, it was seen as being chaotic, as inefficient, not working. And then here we have the situation that we're talking about, Rome, leading to the end of the Republic. And we get back to that cycle, Aristotle's cycle, right? You get into this chaos. When people are in chaos, you look at Syria today, right? Had this civil war. Eventually, what people want when their world is destroyed and there's we take normalcy for granted. We take stability for granted. But when it's gone, is probably what people want the most after that. Is that what happened in Rome? Yeah, this 100 years, more than 100 years of what seems to be political chaos. And eventually people just want stability. I mean, of course, many people have come and gone during that period.
Right. I would say that's entirely accurate. And specifically, I mean, we have 100 years of upheaval. But, you know, by the time that Augustus is finally ending things, let's say this is in 27 BC, you're talking about just 20 years of nonstop civil war, right? That generation. And I actually talk about there's a long digression that I go into in the History of Rome podcast, where I talk about this particular generation that was born around 60 or 70 BC, who were just put on this earth to know nothing but destruction and famine and internecine strife and, you know, brothers killing brothers just because they happen to be assigned to different legions. And just, I mean, the destruction of everything, the depopulation of Italy is like a huge part of this. Yeah. And it's insane that the Roman civilization sort of kept going. It's an amazing conversation in its own right that Roman civilization managed to survive this nonstop struggles. But yeah, I mean, when Augustus finally wins and Antony has been defeated and he's like, all right, it's all over. I murdered all my enemies. People were like, okay, can we stop now? Like, let's stop with all the stuff and you do whatever it is that you want to do. And that sounds great. And what one of the other things is that through this whole period, all of these sort of grievances that people had, all of this resentment that they had, all of these needs that needed to be addressed, that somebody like Gaius Gracchus is actually trying to address in the 120s, had still never really been taken care of. The Senate had consistently failed to address all of these issues. That by the time Augustus comes along, Augustus is saying, I will do it all, but I'm going to do it more or less. I mean, he plays a game about the Republic still existing, but it's like, I'm going to do it by executive fiat. People are like, great, go for it. Like, we don't mourn the death of the Republic. Like, we don't care about those guys. If the Senate doesn't really have power anymore, what's it to me? I don't care about those guys. They never addressed any of my issues anyway. Now, what's interesting is that the fall of the aristocratic element of Rome, which is the Senate, which was in a major way driven by this popular democratic, you know, energy, as predicted by Aristotle's theory, then they overthrow. It does lead to chaos and anarchy. And then you have the strong man come back around. And you could say that, you know, as a model of enlightened despotism, Augustus does a pretty good job, yeah. You know, in the sense of he ruled well. He ruled by this point. I mean, his enemies are dead, so he doesn't have to worry about it too much. But he sort of rules on behalf of everyone, including just mere provincials. You know, he does have kind of an enlightened view of things. And he's in charge also. This is a big part of it, is that he's in charge for decades, right? So he's able to cement a lot of these reforms that were well in need of being done. So he's this enlightened monarch. Well, Aristotle's theory predicts that it devolves into mere tyranny and that there's an aristocratic response. Well, you go out from Augustus a couple years, who are you running into? Caligula, who is just, you know, one of, God, I forget exactly what it is, a great grandnephew of Augustus.
Yeah.
Nero is going to come along. I mean, it slides into that, you know, that tyranny, that despotism that sort of demands an aristocratic response, which never comes.
Never comes.
Never comes. So for the next 500 years, Rome will remain an autocracy. And when the Julio-Claudian dynasty is overthrown, when Nero is overthrown and new emperors come into play, it's new emperors, and it continues to be an autocracy. So the triumph of the monarchical element of the Polybian constitution or the Aristotelian constitution, well, they just persist then forever. And there never is an aristocratic overthrow of the despot, as opposed to just the individual, but the system of despotism never gets overthrown and it continues to persist.
Mike Duncan is the author of the book, The Storm Before the Storm. It is about the beginning of the end of the ancient Roman Republic. This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Hope you'll join us on Monday. We're going to dive into the history of the Monroe Doctrine. This after John Bolton, now Trump's national security advisor, has said that they're going by the Monroe Doctrine when they look at Latin America and in particular Venezuela. So we're going to dive into the history of the Monroe Doctrine, what it is and how it evolved over the years. But first, my friends, we are down to our final 5.5 minutes. Wanted to bring you as much of this conversation as we possibly could because I wanted to make it a learning experience, and I hope it was for you. We are at $2,400 so far this hour, and this is the last day that this radio program will be asking you for your contribution in our winter fund drive. And we are now just 5 minutes away. I indicated, and I know that we're just doing the best, very best we can, and I know you're doing what you can as well. If there's any way we can get to that $4,500 mark today, we will actually get real close to that $3,000 average that we need to be able to make in order to make our fund drives like this one, in which we bring you shows about Henry David Thoreau and Frederick Douglass, the fall of the Roman Republic, the epic story of Gilgamesh. I'm trying to remember all the shows. History of the New Deal would be another one. The history of socialism in America and how Karl Marx thought about America's Civil War, which is, I think, a story you usually don't get. It's your support that makes that possible. But we also need to basically be able to raise on average about $3,000 in this format to be able to justify it. So we're down to 4 minutes. The phone number where you could help us for KPFA is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, it's 818-985-5735,
818-985-5735 and online at kpfk.org. 3.5 minutes to go. One person calling in. So at this very moment, it's not looking good. But I tell you, you know, we have the capacity. We have phone room volunteers. We have capacity to actually raise a lot of money in a very short period of time. So if you want to support us in trying to get where we need to be here on the last day of this radio program's time and asking you for that donation, want to urge you to go to your phones right now. Again, for KPFA, that phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, online at kpfk.org. If you could pledge $80, we'll send you this book, The Storm Before the Storm. I very much enjoyed it. Yours for $80. There's a Letters and Politics Mondo Pack, which is all our history-related interviews together, over 200 interviews, more than 120 hours worth of material, all the history programs that we have done on a USB drive that you plug into your computer for $180. And then we have an end of the drive pack. You can get, and this is pretty impressive, you can get The Storm Before the Storm and the Letters and Politics Mondo Pack together for just $200. We'll knock off $60 of that pledge rate. Still stuck on that one caller. Here's the number, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. I do want to thank Albert in San Francisco for his generosity. Stephanie in Berkeley, thank you, Stephanie, for your very kind note. David in Berkeley, thank you, David, for your continued support. Jeffrey in Richmond. Jeffrey, I think you're going to enjoy the book. Thank you, sir. D. Robin in Richmond, thank you for your generosity. Sebastian in San Francisco, thank you for that. John in Martinez. Lawrence in Hayward. Tim in Vallejo, thank you for your nice note there, Tim. Chris in San Francisco. Let me scroll up, see if we... okay, just one caller. I think it's the end for us, folks, but it's been a pleasure anyways. We have 45 seconds to go. Ooh, what did I do last time? Tim, let's pick up where we were. Chris in San Francisco. Chris, thank you for your contribution. Linda in San Mateo. Thank you, Linda. Carol in Berkeley. Claudia in Santa Rosa. Suzanne in Fresno. And Simon in Berkeley. Look, in the end, I'm just incredibly thankful to you all for... There's one more caller. Thank you. Let me thank you now. I'm incredibly thankful, actually, to you all who have donated during this fund drive. It means a tremendous amount to me. I know folks are doing the best they can, and that's all we can ask for at that point. So let me give the number one last time, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732.
Next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Kevin Anderson, Talk to the Oxford Climate Society. Opening with Greta Thunberg. In August 2018, at age 15, Greta Thunberg started the first school strike for climate outside the Swedish Parliament. She skipped classes and maintained a regular presence every Friday. At first, Greta Thunberg was often alone. But slowly her presence was noticed, even outside Sweden, and by the time she addressed the United Nations Climate Change Conference in December 2018 in Poland, and the World Economic Forum at Davos, Switzerland, in January 2019, her courageous and well-researched talks were seen by hundreds of thousands via the internet. When she came to Brussels, Belgium, the school strike movement was already in full swing there with weekly walkouts. And she called seven young student organizers on the stage with her, Greta Thunberg, speaking to European Union politicians in Brussels.
Tens of thousands of children are school striking for the climate on the streets of Brussels. Hundreds of thousands are doing the same all over the world. We are school striking because we have done our homework. And some of us are here today. People always tell us that they are so hopeful. They are hopeful that the young people are going to save the world. But we are not. There is simply not enough time to wait for us to grow up and become the ones in charge. Because by the year 2020, we need to have bended the emissions curve steep downwards. That is next year. We know that most politicians don't want to talk to us. Good. We don't want to talk to them either. We want them to talk to the scientists instead. Listen to them. Because we are just repeating what they are saying and have been saying for decades. We want you to follow the Paris Agreement and the IPCC report. We don't have any other manifests or demands. Just unite behind the science. That is our demand. Once you have done your homework, you realize that we need new politics. We need new economics where everything is based on a rapidly declining and extremely limited remaining carbon budget. But that is not enough. We need a whole new way of thinking. The political system that you have created is all about competition. You cheat when you can because all that matters is to win, to get power. That must come to an end. We must stop competing with each other. We need to cooperate and work together and to share the resources of the planet in a fair way. We need to start living within the planetary boundaries, focus on equity, and take a few steps back for the sake of all living species. We need to protect the biosphere, the air, the oceans, the soil, the forests. This may sound very naive, but if you have done your homework, then you know that we don't have any other choice. We need to focus every inch of our being on climate change, because if we fail to do so, then all our achievements and progress have been for nothing. And all that will remain of our political leaders' legacy will be the greatest failure of human history. And they will be remembered as the greatest villains of all time because they have chosen not to listen and not to act. This does not have to be. There is still time. According to the IPCC report, we are about 11 years away from being in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction beyond human control. To avoid that, unprecedented changes in all aspects of society need to have taken place within this coming decade, including a reduction of our CO2 emissions by at least 50% by the year 2030. And please note that those numbers do not include the aspect of equity, which is absolutely necessary to make the Paris Agreement work on a global scale, nor do they include tipping points or feedback loops, like the extremely powerful methane gas released from the thawing Arctic permafrost. They do, however, include negative emission techniques on a huge planetary scale that is yet to be invented. and that many scientists fear will never be ready in time and will anyway be impossible to deliver at the scale assumed. If the EU is to make its fair contribution to staying within the carbon budget for the 2-degree limit, then it needs a minimum of 80% reduction by 2030. And that includes aviation and shipping. So around twice as ambitious as the current proposal. The actions required are beyond manifestos or any party politics. Some people say that we are fighting for our future. But that is not true. We are not fighting for our future. We are fighting for everyone's future. And if you think that we should be in school instead, then we suggest that you take our place in the streets, striking from your work. Or better yet, join us so we can speed up the process. And I'm sorry, but saying everything will be all right while continue doing nothing at all is just not hopeful to us. In fact, it's the opposite of hope. And yet, this is exactly what you keep doing. You can't just sit around waiting for hope to come. Then you're acting like spoiled, irresponsible children. You don't seem to understand that hope is something you have to earn. And if you still say that we are wasting valuable lesson time, then let me remind you that our political leaders have wasted decades through denial and inaction. And since our time is running out, we have decided to take action. We have started to clean up your mess, and we will not stop until we are done. Thank you.
That was Greta Thunberg speaking to European Union politicians in Brussels. As I'm recording this, the call is out for March 15, 2019, worldwide walkout of students, including in the US. And here is the conclusion of the talk to the Oxford Climate Society by Professor Kevin Anderson, the chair of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester, UK. He said in part one, imagine if the world's top 10% carbon emitters were to reduce their carbon footprint to the average European, there would be about a one-third cut in global emissions. End quote. Targeting the top emitters is very much in line with Anderson's respect for climate equity and justice. Here's what he has to say about energy efficiency standards.
In the near to medium term, we need really tight efficiency standards. On the demand side, you can make rapid changes in emissions, but you can only do that if you've got policies to stop the rebound effects. Now, energy efficiency has never brought a reduction in anything. It almost always feeds into economic growth. So efficiency benefits overall just help you grow your economy, help you increase your emissions. But that doesn't mean to say that it has to do that. You could put policies in there to help overcome that, you know, progressive metering tariffs. There's a whole suite of things you could do, but we've never done that historically. But if you look at something like an A-rated refrigerator, and then look at an A++++ refrigerator for the same size, there's between a 60 and 80% difference in energy consumption. 60 to 80%. So why are we selling rubbish A-rated refrigerators? Because we have a liberalised choice system, so we can buy crap if we really want to. But if you just said, well, the standard's got to be an A++++ this year, next year it has to be 10% better, and the year after that 10% better, you could very rapidly change energy on the demand side. Same with cars. Why is it we're selling cars at 200 and 250 grams when you can buy an IC engine, a internal combustion engine car, at 85 to 100 grams, even with the VW scams? You can still get cars much lower that will take three children's seats in the back and, you know, still do 70 or 80 miles an hour on the motorway. So why are we selling ones with high grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour? If you put standards in to drive these things, you would rapidly shift things through. About 60 to 80% of all the vehicle kilometres travelled in the UK, and for most of the EU countries this is true, are travelled by cars that are under 8 years old. So it takes very little time to percolate through the system if you change demand with policies around it to stop the rebound effect. And the rebound effect is important because you find in the EU We've had no reduction in transport fuel emissions over the last few years, and we've had an increase in the US over the last year. So efficiency, really important. And of course, we have to do the thing that we always talk about, energy supply. Energy supply is massively important, but it cannot deliver in the time frame we want. And therefore, you have to do these things here. So it's, I sort of call it like a Marshall-style construction of Europe. And obviously, the Marshall Plan came with all quite nasty other issues in it politically. But the actual sort of infrastructure change is what I'm talking about, that scale of change. And even that wouldn't be as big as what we'd have to make. So this is like energy supply and massive electrification. Remember, only 20% of the final energy we consume, not the primary, it's always worth separating those two, of the final energy we consume, only 20% is electricity. 80% of it is not electricity. So you've got to have a massive level of electrification, probably a threefold, if not a fourfold increase in electrification. What we're saying, regardless whether you're, you know, whether you're a socialist or a rabid laissez-faire type, the basic maths tell you here to change the infrastructure, the physical infrastructure, the world in which we live. So it's just like Roosevelt going in, you know, and telling the companies they've got to change what they were doing. It's just like us introducing rationing in the Second World War. You have to start to say we've got a limited amount of resources, there's a limited amount of labour, and they've got to be doing the things like this if we're going to respond to climate change. And this is even if you have big improvements in efficiency and reductions in energy demand. The UK is about 1,800 terawatt hours. So I would think you could probably get it down to something like 1,000 to 1,200 terawatt hours. Just remember it's 1,800. So when people start talking about electricity at 300 to 330, just remember what the real figures are. So this is a shift in productive capacity, I would argue, at least similar to what we saw in World War II. There are very, very few parallels out there. The sort of shift we're talking about, you can't use acid rain or ozone or any of these things. Probably you have to go right back to things like the abolition of slavery. Yeah, slavery was the principal structure by which we ran our economies in the US and much of Europe. And when it was abolished, that took a long time. Very sadly, what we had to do was actually we ended up compensating the slave owners, which I find quite reprehensible. We may have to think about how do you do that now? How do you compensate the Saudi Arabias, the Qatars, the BPs, the Shells? Do we have to do that? Is that going to be part of our solution? I'm really uncomfortable about that. But maybe lessons in history tell us we can't just make that change without thinking about those things. I hope we can find a way around that. We are talking about changes that are only have occurred in sort of post-Enlightenment on a handful of occasions. Maybe, you know, the emancipation of women and universal suffrage is another one. But there are very few of these examples. And the sorts of shifts I'm talking about are, you know, all the things that as academics, and know if you come to Oxford, you're desperate trying to do this anyway. So you come here to get a good education, so you can get a good job, to get more money, so you can buy more stuff and have a higher carbon footprint. That's the main reason you come to Oxford. I know that's not completely true. I bet I can guarantee most of the time, 10 years from now, you'll have a higher carbon footprint than you have now. 10 years after that, it'll be higher again. Large houses, holiday homes, second homes, prestige cars, SUVs, multiple car ownerships, highly mobile lives. Academics love that. We fly around the world at taxpayers' expense. Frequent flyers, business class, first travel, high levels of consumer goods. You know, all the things that we aspire to, all the things that our world tells us, yeah, this is about prestige. This tells us we're doing something right. But the resources going to provide these, this is a huge proportion of our resources, which is why you see this when you look at the emissions curves. The reason the emissions are in this particular group is because that's where the resources are. So let's not pretend the resources are sort of spread out amongst the poor. They're not. They're highly concentrated in a particular small group of society that includes me. And we need those resources, that labour and materials to help us make this transformation from an 81% fossil fuel energy system to a zero fossil fuel energy infrastructure in 20 years. This is a zero carbon industrial strategy. This is hugely challenging. Way beyond, I think, anything that anyone is yet contemplating, really. I can see why people say this is just not possible. We're not going to deliver this. And I think we're on the cusp of failing on this and heading somewhere pretty appalling. But I think there are some early signs of possible deep system change. And I wrote this, I thought about this when I was coming back from Bonn, which was an appalling event. Katowice was much better than Bonn. Bonn was just terrible. The COP a couple of years ago. But whether you're a politician, a scientist, academic, business people, journalists, or civil society, we're all going to hell in a handcart at the moment. We're all going somewhere which we don't want to be. There's virtually no positive stories out there at any large-scale collective level. That's not to say that we're awash with lots of positive stories at smaller scales, but we're not seeing anything at a large scale, which is why the emissions keep going up. So is there light in despair? And when I was coming back from Bonn, I was on the train back up from Bonn, back up to Sweden, which is where I work part of the time, and I was quite depressed, so I was trying to write something cathartic to try and lift my mood on the train, and I had a couple of days to do it. So I wrote something, which then got picked up by The Conversation and was published by them. It's also on my website. And it was just hope from chaos. Could political upheaval lead to a new green epoch? And it is, you know, desperately looking at straws to grab, but are there any straws to grab, and are they reasonable to think about? And I was thinking about post-2008 at the time, it's 10 years. What are the things we might have seen? The banking crisis, quantitative easing. Go back to 2006, even halfway through 2007, and say to chancellors, just say to all the economic pontificators that we'd like the government to write a cheque for £500 trillion. They'd think you were mad. They were doing it a year later. No shortage of money. Okay, well, not all of it was real, some of it was fabricated, but most of this money was spent on resources one way or another. So overnight, the UK managed to find... Well, it found about $250 billion overnight, and it took a little bit longer to find the other $500 billion. So it found huge quantities of money. And it could have used that, like Korea and China did in part, to help drive a sort of greening infrastructure. It didn't. They just squandered it in its usual sort of reckless fashion. But we had a huge amount of money. It could have helped us retrofit the houses, done a lot with our energy system. And that's not just here, but many parts of the world. We've got social media. Now, I'm actually all in favour of social media. Give me the choice between four rich white men that own the papers in the UK or 60 million nutters sending me tweets. I'll take the 60 million nutters every time. Because at last, we managed to escape the idea that our media and the stories we hear about have been controlled for 100 years by particular ways of looking at the world, particular types of people that come from, particular type of institutions that have run things. And that's not saying they're bad people, it's not saying the news hasn't, some of them been really interesting, but it comes with a particular take, a particular set of baggage, inevitably. I prefer the social media there, even though it comes with a lot of really major problems. But I think there are some real merits to opening up the space so that all sorts of people can have their voices heard. So I'm not opposed to social media, though I think we have to find somewhere trying to control some of its worst excesses. Sanders and Corbyn, not saying there's a good or bad. Well, I have my views, you can take your own pick on them. You know, these are people who have really radical positions. Sanders stood up and said he's a socialist and wasn't shot in America. That's quite an achievement. Corbyn, the PLP, the Labour Party, didn't like Corbyn. The BBC didn't like him. The Guardian didn't like him. Let alone the right. I mean, the Conservatives loathed him, and so did Telegraph. But no one supported Corbyn. But it's interesting how through social media he had been moderately successful and had quite an influence. The same thing with Sanders in the US. Brexit, Trump, whoever thought these things were going to happen? You go back to a year before each of these occurred, no one thought this is going to happen. This is just ridiculous. Of course we're not going to do that. We're not going to come out of the EU. Which idiot would ever put the vote forward anyway? And which idiot would vote for it? I'm not saying we're idiots by doing it, but that's what our sort of view would have been. Yeah, we had that. Who would vote for Trump? Who would vote for the Swedish Democrats, an ex-Nazi party in Sweden? 18% of people in Sweden voted for them. So there's a whole new anti-establishment constituency here. And actually, I'm really pleased they're voting. I'm not pleased they're voting for these people. And I was talking with Oliver earlier about this. I think, you know, they're voting for these people because progressive lefties like me have not provided a good narrative for what a positive future looks like for these people in the Dust Belt or in the Rhondda Valley or the northeast of the UK who have had their industries decimated. So there's a whole scope of here, a new constituency who want to have their voices heard and want to see a new world. The Arab Spring, okay, ended up being a bloodbath, but I mean, there were benefits out of their Arab Spring. New voices coming to the fore, continuing plummeting price of renewables. They're not yet showing any sign of bottoming out. Latest offshore round for offshore wind turbines is half the price of the last round. Now they've not delivered them yet, but if they do deliver them at that price, that's an incredible shift in the prices, which is already creating some instability in the market. And solar panels just keep coming down in price all the time, or solar power does. And also then there's concerns about fossil fuel impacts on health, which were not there before, and even the IMF are engaged in this. So there's a whole suite of these things there, and what I'm arguing is that in themselves these disruptions are important, but they're still sort of in isolation, they're evolutionary, they're not revolutionary. At the time they feel revolutionary, like the banking crisis, but what do? We found new ways to lightly regulate the banks and just wait for the next crisis. So the same people in charge, nothing really significant occurred. But at the time it felt revolutionary, but it's turned out to be an evolutionary shift. But if you could align some of these things, if you could actually start to say, how do we bring some of these things together? Are there ways that we can manipulate the system? The we here is not going to be the establishment most of the time. Some of them perhaps, but are there ways that we can manipulate the system? And actually then maybe we could start to see something when you bring these together, whatever they might be, something much more revolutionary. I don't think the world is this static place that if you live in Oxford or Manchester, we go to university every day, it feels the same every day. There are big changes occurring all around us in all sorts of ways, but they're not aligned in any way, and some of them are obviously very bad as well. So could it be much more revolutionary? Most political and economic pontificators, this is just taken from the piece, buttressed by naysayers and established elites, remain incapable of seeing beyond their familiar 20th century horizon. And in universities, I would argue most of the time it's the 19th century, probably in Latin. But the 21st century is already proving how the future is a different country, one that could yet be shaped by alternative interpretations of prosperity, sustainability and equity. So I think we are starting to see different stories, different narratives coming out. And again, it's our role to some extent to try and foster those if we are supportive of them. So do we have something to offer this new agenda? Are we prepared to think post-growth? I'm not saying degrowth. I prefer the idea of just moving away from the concept of growth at all, degrowth or post-growth. Just let's look at things in their own units, if you like. Don't have to see them as growing or shrinking. You know, I'd like to see more improved female literacy around the world. That's growth, but it doesn't really necessarily play out in economic growth. Be open-minded to technical opportunities, but also to their limitations. Consider short-term rationing of energy. Don't think there's a way around that. We have to be open about that. We have to deliver some sort of rationing. We can go away from the rationing later on once we've solved the problem, if it fits with other sustainability criteria, which it may or may not. But from a climate perspective, we have to ration it. I think we have to stand up to the bullying of the city and of the Davos set. And I would also say a really deep-seated tyranny that occurs within our universities. And I spoke in the piece I wrote coming back from Katowice this year, I spoke about that, having spoke to a lot of early career researchers who just said they daren't ask questions. They daren't ask questions at COP. They daren't ask questions of their supervisors. You know, what are we doing in universities if we're stopping younger voices who have not got the baggage that we've got yet speaking out? We should be, you know, really encourage them to speak out openly. I repeatedly hear that from early career researchers and people on short-term contracts, that they can't speak out openly against their established peers. So do we have the cogency, tenacity and courage to escape? And I tried all sorts of other words for this, but none of them really captured it. I don't think there's a neat way around it. I think we are, it's this sort of neoliberal black hole that we have. And depends how you look at that, sort of as a laissez-faire view of the world, sort of the current socioeconomic paradigm that's particularly dominant in the US and the UK, slightly less so in some of the European countries. You know, can we escape this way of looking at the world, this Davos sort of mindset? I think we probably can. So to conclude, in 2019, climate change is system change. It wasn't in 1990 we chose to fail. It wasn't in 2000 we carried on failing. By 2019, whether you take the Met Office budget, there's basically nothing left significant. So, you know, we are talking about taking the budget and then asking questions of our norms and our paradigms. We've got to do the obvious, transform energy supply technologies. We have to do that. We need a rapid penetration of energy efficiency technologies. These things are really there. We can start to make those transitions today. And there are big issues around storage and intermittency to some extent and frequency control and all those things, but they're all resolvable in a reasonable time frame. This is probably very difficult. We need profound shifts in our behaviours and our practices. And I don't just mean tweaks. I mean, do we mean profound shifts in them? We need to reframe value, success and progress. Why do we only see, you see success in celebrity, in stars and successful business people? Not if you're a nurse looking after children with cystic fibrosis. That's not success. Why is that not success? Why are they paid, you know, £30,000 a year and yet we pay some, you know, hedge fund manager or developer or whatever it might be, some huge salary, or even a professor? You know, why do I get paid more than a Virgin train driver? We've got to start to rethink what is important in our society and how we should be measuring those things. This is very difficult, and I would argue that's the case for sustainability, but in the short term, it's definitely the case for climate change. We need an economic model that's fit for purpose. I don't know what your various backgrounds are, but I come from an engineering background. If I was doing work on aerodynamics over a car, or even over my bike, if I'm going really fast, I'm going to use turbulent flow. If I'm going really slowly, I'm going to use laminar flow. I would never muddle the two up because it'd be meaningless. And yet in economics, the economic model we use is basically a general equilibrium, marginal economic model. No, it's about small changes near equilibrium. We're nowhere near equilibrium, and we're talking about step changes. So no other field of academic endeavour would ever use a model that was completely and utterly inappropriate to drive the framing of our agenda. And that's repeatedly what we do here. It's like using Newton to understand quantum mechanics. Why on earth are we doing that? There are plenty of good economic models out there with a much better framing, like ecological economics in its various forms, to address this issue. The current model is just not fit for purpose, and yet it dominates the debate. All of this has got to start now and be completed in about 3 decades. So it's, from an academic point of view, it's quite interesting, because I think the paper's blank to some extent. You know, we may know what the strategy is, but we don't really know what the policies look like, and they will be different between different countries. We've got a long way to go. Do we really care about these people when we think it's perfectly reasonable to have an increase in private yacht sales during the period of austerity? Yeah. During austerity, private yacht sales went up. Do we really care about our own future, own children's future, when we've got the Gates and the Virgins and the, what's his name, Musk, developing space travel, which I always sort of jokingly say I'm not completely against as long as the tickets are one way. So, because, you know, there will be people with high carbon footprints will always be on board. So I'm quite happy to see them go to Pluto. Do we care about future generations when we think it's perfectly reasonable to drive around in a 3 tons car? Yeah, we think about what could be in there. It could be me. I'm 83 kilograms. 83 kilometers of flesh and 3,000 kilograms of car. Driving, 6 kilometres to pick up 10 kilograms of groceries. Is that a reasonable thing to do in 2019? And if it's a Tesla, it's still no better. You know, slightly less worse, perhaps. We've got migrants. What the first thing we do when we see migrants, we put up razor wire. And, yeah, I regularly cycle past houses like this in Cheshire with lots of bedrooms that could fit in migrants. So, you know, are we really concerned about those sorts of things we're starting to see around us? Do we really worry about other species and other ecosystems? Well, EU is building a massive gas network now. And the Swedes, who hardly use any gas, are building a new gas terminal in Gothenburg to bring over shale gas in the rest of the world. So we're locking in a high carbon infrastructure right at this moment. The EU is spending our tax money, probably not Britain soon, but anyway, our tax money on building 2 massive gas pipelines. So we really, really worry about the beauty of living this fantastic planet, the little blue dot in this inky darkness when we merrily fly to another essential climate change conference or holiday in Bali. I do have quite a few discussions with Alex Stephan on Twitter, but I really like this quote he used here. Or I think this is just one he made up. Winning slowly is basically the same thing as losing outright. In the face of both triumphant denialism and predatory delay, triumphant denialism is just what Trump does and some others. And I don't really care about them too much. And the predatory delay, that's what the climate progressives do. That's what we do as an academic community. We're always trying to find some way to delay action. And I think that's much more dangerous. Trying to achieve climate action by doing the same thing, the same old ways, means defeat. It guarantees defeat. And at the moment, just look at everything around us in terms of the aggregate impacts. Not the good things that are going on here and there, but the aggregate impacts. Everything is pointing in the wrong direction. Emissions up again 2.7% in 2018. So we are guaranteeing defeat unless we start to think radically differently. But I'm trying to suggest, I think, and I know other people don't agree with me on this, I think we can still just have an outside chance of 2 degrees centigrade if we're prepared to address the political, social and economic implications as well as the technical ones. So thanks for listening.
That was Professor Kevin Anderson, the Chair of Energy and Climate Change at the School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester. He spoke on January 25, 2019 at the Oxford Climate Society in the UK. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. This program was produced off the electric grid with solar power in the mountains of Northern California. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
So I wanted to talk about your article about the Trudeau Doctrine first, just yesterday's article. This is something, you know, we're talking about a few areas here. We're talking about the SNC-Lavalin and the Liberal government and Haiti and Venezuela. You're one of the few people who can put this together. And what some people might see as a bunch of separate stories or a bunch of separate issues, you understand them in their totality to a greater extent. So you are looking at Venezuela, and in the case of Canada, this is where we have a big role, and you've been one of the people in covering this. So when you're talking about a Trudeau Doctrine, a way of structuring thought and action for Canada, This Venezuela interference is something that falls under that Trudeau doctrine. You took the title from the Monroe Doctrine. Most of our listeners should hopefully be familiar with that. But briefly, if people don't know what the Monroe Doctrine was, what was that?
It was a doctrine put forward by a U.S. president that initially back in 1823 said that the European powers were not supposed to meddle in the Western Hemisphere. And so it was kind of framed initially as this sort of anti-imperialist kind of doctrine. And over the years, it became a little more than a cover for the U.S. to decide what government should be in what country, and became a justification for U.S. Intervention in all kinds of different forms.
Yeah, something that's coming back in a big way, although it never really left. Now, for us here in Canada, we have this Trudeau Doctrine, and a lot of actions could be understood to fall under that. So when you're talking about what that consists of, or what are the main elements, or what are the elements of this Trudeau Doctrine as you see it?
Well, I mean, it's a certain way of kind of framing this aggressive intervention. You have to understand that Canada is leading this charge against the government in Venezuela. Canada has brought about sanctions, three rounds of sanctions, illegal sanctions against the government in Venezuela, has been condemning the government in very, very harsh terms, has organized a coalition of countries to oppose the regional coalition to oppose the Venezuelan government, the so-called Lima group of countries. Canada and Peru were the main backers of that group about 2 years ago. Canada has been supporting opposition groups. Goes back quite a few years, at least about 15 years, but in a very aggressive form over the past 2 years, has really been conspiring with oppositional forces in Venezuela, and in the past couple of months was right at the forefront of the secret campaign to build support for the head of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, declaring himself president of the country. Canada was involved in the backroom negotiation on that issue for a couple months before it took place. Canada has been just really sort of pushing this regime change effort in Venezuela. Now, it's doing so under the guise of saying that we're trying to support the Venezuelan constitution, saying that we're trying to support democracy, saying that this regional coalition, Lima Group, is, you know, working outside of the control of the regional hegemon, i.e. the U.S., But in fact, it's working. Canada is working hand in hand with the U.S. In fact, Canada is undercutting the Venezuelan constitution that it says it's upholding. In fact, it's undermining democracy in Venezuela. So I think that's where the idea of a Trudeau doctrine sort of comes in, where it's this certain kind of framing of Canadian actions in a certain type of light. And I should say, going further with it, some of the rhetoric that Canadian officials have used to justify this aggressive intervention in Venezuela is to refer to Venezuela as in our neighborhood or in our backyard. That's the language of ugly American U.S. politicians who have been, you know, upholding the Monroe Doctrine for a century. So this is the language of aggressive interventionist policy.
Yeah, we've heard this before. I mean, and you pointed out in the article, and I'm glad you did, Eve, because you quoted Chrystia Freeland, who, of course, is at the center of this with regard to Venezuela, and she's referring to our activity there, and she says, "This is our neighborhood. For Canadians, we have a very direct interest in what happens in our hemisphere. That is why we have been so active, and we will continue to be so active." And when she said that, it didn't come too long after, you know, Bill Maher said on American TV, you know, "This is our backyard," with reference to Trump and others being in Venezuela. So there's this idea that Canada and the United States can and should be directly involved in the internal politics of other countries because it's our neighborhood or our backyard.
Exactly, it's basically a legitimating an effort to overthrow an elected government.
Yeah, you know, if you step back from all of this, and your article has such great highlights when you think about some of the what you're pointing out here. One of them is first, Canada is taking a front line. Like a lead role in this coup. So we're not just tagging along some other countries. Canada has been organizing main elements of this coup. And you talked about the Lima Group. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more, because you said that, like, it was way back in 2017, Canada's organizing this group outside of the Organization of American States and trying to make it look like the U.S. is not involved. So what did we do to put together like this Lima Group? Because it looks like we set up some meetings. We got this thing rolling a couple years ago.
Yes, I mean, back in May of 2017, Trudeau personally met with the wife of the head of Juan Guaido's party, Voluntad Popular, Leopoldo Lopez, who's was in jail, now is under house arrest. So prominent, she was his emissary. So she was going around trying to build up support for this sort of hardline element of the opposition within Venezuela. We have, at the same month, 2017, May of 2017, Trudeau having a conversation with the head of state in Peru on Venezuela. And this was in the context of the Organization of American States refusing to censure Venezuela. That was why Canada and Peru set up the Lima Group, was because we couldn't get the diplomatic censure via the OAS. And it should be noted that the OAS, the head of the OAS, is vehemently opposed to the Maduro government in Venezuela. So even in this body that's led by somebody who's very hostile to the Venezuelan government, there was a refusal primarily from the Caribbean countries to go down this interventionist path. So Canada's been, been at the forefront. I mean, both the Associated Press, the Canadian Press, have both reported that they were working in the Canadian Press article for months, according to a named Canadian diplomat, to build this coalition both internally within Venezuela to support Juan Guaido's declaration of himself as president, and also regionally in terms of bringing on more countries. And this is really where Canada has been right at the forefront, which is the Lima Group. There was a Lima Group meeting in Ottawa. There's been at least two Lima Group meetings in Canada now, so I think that's the most of any country. So this is Canada right at the forefront, aid. Canada biggest announcement of aid, which is really sort of a thinly guised effort to demonize the Venezuelan government and to try to stoke conflict, the Canadian aid policy.
I just got to let, for people that are just tuning in now, of course, we're speaking with Canadian author, journalist, and activist Eve Engler, author of 10 books, and at eveengler.ca. Is it eveengler.ca or eveengler.com?
.com.
It's Eve, YVESENGLER.com. You can find Eve's articles on rabble.ca, on Socialist Project, The Bullet, in Counterpunch, on The Real News, Huffington Post, and elsewhere. He's been writing a lot about Canada's involvement there. Involvement is a nice way to put it. In Venezuela. And I should point out, by the way, this is our fundraising week. This kind of programming, you won't find it on CBC. I don't know how often CBC interviews Eve Engler, but we interview Eve, and we play Taylor Report episodes with Eve and others and many Canadian writers and journalists and authors and activists. So if you want to support this programming, keep it going, you can call us live at 905-528-9888, or you can go to cfmu.ca and click on the donate thing at the bottom of the page, and there's a yellow donate button. You can do that anytime this week. Just say it's for us, Unusual Sources. But this is, we have to stick together. We have to highlight Canadian authors that are actually doing real journalism. Eve must be one of the few actual journalists in North America and actually looking at, in this case, what our country is doing. You made an amazing argument or a discovery there, Eve, that really needs to be pointed out because no one else is going to do this. And that is, you were talking about the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in the article from yesterday. This kind of fits in with the Trudeau Doctrine, as you've been putting it. I think the government right now, especially under Trudeau, is making itself out to be a defender of this kind of neoliberal order, you know, the free trade agreements and the interventionist structures that were set up by Washington. The International Criminal Court is one of those interventionist institutions. They're never used against the core powers, the imperial countries, Canada, the U.S., France. It's never used against the Anglo-American alliance, but it's used against all sorts of other countries, mostly in Africa. And so if I get this right from your article, it looks like Trudeau wants to show that Canada will use the ICC against South American countries. So it's kind of backing this Ignatieff-style humanitarian imperialism against Trump's more, you know, overt militarism. So, you know, how are we wielding the ICC here?
Well, back in September, Canada with a handful of other Latin American countries brought Venezuela to the International Criminal Court. This is the first time ever that a member state has brought another member state to the prosecutor to, you know, investigate the matter of supposed human rights violations. So of all the human rights violations that have taken place in the past, 15 or so years since the ICC has been around, I think it's 20, it's over 20 years now, I think. Venezuela is in this unique position. Now, when announcing this back in September, there was a whole framing of how this was at the UN General Assembly. There was a whole framing that Canadian politicians and Canadian media put on this move, which was that the Trump administration is against the ICC, and this was a sign. Canada's bringing Venezuela to the ICC was a sign of Canada kind of pushing back against the Trump administration and defending the so-called rules-based international order. Now, the fact there was a CBC article by Evan Dyer who really delved into this and framed it just as the government wanted him to. The idea that this was sort of like bucking the Trump administration is just beyond belief. I mean, this is clearly aligned with the Trump administration's desire to overthrow the Venezuelan government. And it was clearly aligned with Canadian and U.S. sanctions against Venezuela, which were an explicit violation of the U.N. Charter, of the Organization of American States Charter. So, a clear violation of the so-called international rules-based order that Canada was claiming to uphold with this effort of bringing Venezuela to the ICC. Also violation of the non-intervention clauses in the U.N. and OAS. This is part of the Trudeau doctrine, the sort of framing themselves as part of this like liberal, post World War II world order, and upholding this, but it's quite frankly just sort of naked imperialism.
Well, yes, and we'll come back to that rules-based order in just a moment. It's interesting you pointed out. I mean, I think this is something that applies in a number of instances or in a multiple way, because in the article from yesterday, the Trudeau Doctrine, in the bullet, it said you had this quote from Jean Chrétien telling Bill Clinton back when they were in government. Chrétien said, "Keeping some distance will be good for both of us. If we look as though we're the 51st state of the United States, there's nothing we can do for you internationally, just as a governor of a state can't do anything for you internationally. But if we look independent enough, we can do things for you that even the CIA cannot do." And this is a reflection of the role Canada also played during the Cold War as sort of a good cop or someone that could talk to countries the United States wasn't talking to, but really to carry out Washington's directives. And now we're seeing that, this policy continues where we play a more diplomatic role of delivering the same thing. It feels like, you know, the Trudeau government and Freeland as well have been just giving a different flavor of what Washington is promoting. Just like when Freeland said, you know, she was defying Trump on, you know, a variety of issues, but Syria, Venezuela, Iran, they're not defying the U.S. government. So they're putting together a more diplomatic spin, it looks like.
I mean, for sure. I mean, the Lima group in regards to Venezuela is just a clear example of this. They're claiming this is operating outside of U.S. policy, and it's sort of it's the region coming together and you know, almost kind of trying to frame it as anti-American. But I mean, you have to be you have to be sort of naive beyond belief to not see that this is operating alongside and as you mentioned, this, you know, extends to their policy on the Ukraine, their policy on Syria, their policy on Haiti, Palestine, and many parts of the globe. You see that, in fact, you know, Canada is aligned. Trudeau's government is very much aligned with the U.S.-led empire.
Yeah, well, what I want to finish up with is what the fun that I love it, the rules-based government, rules-based international order. I mean, that's what Trudeau was telling the Chinese. He said, oh, well, we have to extradite that Meng because we have to send her to the U.S., put her in jail, arrest her, because we're a rules-based government. We expect the rule of law trumps everything. And, I mean, your other article looks into that a bit with the article, Canada's Corrupt Foreign Policy Comes Home to Roost. You're looking at SNC-Lavalin in particular. Now, with this big scandal that's going on right now with the Liberal government, you know, a lot of people, they've been hearing about the basics all over the news, so we don't really need to spend much time on that. But you focused on something that is not being looked at, and that is the enormous and central role of SNC-Lavalin in not just business transactions abroad, but also influencing the government. It seems to me, you know, we just talked about Canada being an imperialist actor in South America. So it has business interests, plays favorites, it topples governments. And now at home, we're seeing a reflection of this. You know, as they say, foreign policy is domestic policy, because what SNC-Lavalin has been doing abroad, there's a corresponding activity here. One of the things they like to do abroad is bribe people. And your article examined that. So can you tell us about this serial bribery campaign that SNC-Lavalin did as a regular form of business?
Yeah, I mean, SNC has been either convicted or alleged with, you know, a great deal of evidence of bribing officials in at least 15 countries. It's almost for sure it's into the multiple dozens. Wouldn't at all surprise me if they've bribed officials in more than half the world's countries. But that's been something that's been going on. It's in the news a lot, and particularly with regards to Libya. But there's a whole bunch of different countries, including here in, you know, in Canada too. They've lots of examples of their bribery here in Quebec. And so that's happening, and the Trudeau government's been willing to go to bat for SNC despite these, you know, all this controversy around their bribery. And if you look at SNC-Lavalin, this is a company that's right at the core of Canadian foreign policy. They have been built up historically through Canadian aid funding. It goes back to 1963 in India, the first international project funded by a Canadian aid agency. They oversaw diplomatic offices of Canadian aid agency in the 60s. They have been a big, you know, provided base services for Canadian military in Afghanistan. Huge, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds and hundreds of different contracts they've received from Canadian aid agency for operations around the world. Diplomatic support from Canadian trade commissioners, from support from Export Development Canada, from Canadian Commercial Corporation, from different Canadian politicians, you know, ministers going on delegations. I mean, just on and on and on. They have been supported by the Canadian state in so many different ways. And in one way in which their, you know, sort of their operations kind of have a bit of a made in Ottawa tint to them is with regard to the corruption, because Canada was a complete laggard with bringing in compared to other G7 countries, OECD countries, a laggard in terms of bringing any regulations around Canadian companies bribing officials abroad. In the early 90s, the former head of Lavalin, which then became later on became SNC-Lavalin, stated very clearly that when he paid bribes abroad, he made sure to get a check because you could write it off as a business operation in Canadian tax code. So that was the case into the 90s. The Canadian government refused to bring in any legislation around bribery abroad until they were basically forced to by the OECD. And then it took a decade after this legislation was brought in before the RCMP pursued its first case about foreign bribery. And this is just until just a few years ago. So SNC's corruption abroad is very much have been enabled by Canadian government policy. And so I'd say that now, part of what we're seeing is this this company that's incredibly powerful in Ottawa. It's been so tied in with Canadian foreign policy, exerting some of that power and leading towards a corrupting of the Canadian political legal process. But that story has largely been the broader story has largely been left out of this what they want to make the most kind of narrow Liberal Party scandal that the media can make it.
Yeah, it seems like bribery is a respected way of doing business in Ottawa's view, because they were basically like writing it off or whatever, and it was fully understood and acknowledged and basically codified that SNC-Lavalin would go around bribing people in other countries, and this had been going on for decades, and that the article goes into some more depth on it, but the U.S. had said, we should have rules against this bribery all over the place, and the Canada was like trying to fight that or the last one to sign on, our government has really went out there on a limb to help SNC-Lavalin, and I think what we're seeing, there's a consistent picture here, which is, Canada has business interests, and you, Eve, know about this more than most people because, your study on Haiti, for example, the business interests come to dictate policy. So SNC-Lavalin was involved in Haiti and a number of other manufacturers, and our policy, the government policy on Haiti, was then to overthrow the Aristide government, which had gone against the interests of some of these businesses. So our government is there to, act on the interests of businesses operating abroad. It's to we subsidize our businesses, we help them, we let them get away with bribery and things like that. But the other part of that is we seem to be helping get rid of governments that might try to do something for their own people instead of just kowtowing to Canadian businesses. So that seems to be a consistent factor in Haiti and Venezuela and other places, don't you think?
It's a central factor. I mean, it's an important. Sometimes it's not just directly. I mean, in the case of Venezuela, I think Canada's desire to get rid of the Maduro government is not just that there are Canadian mining companies that want at massive gold reserves in the country. It is partly that, but it's also the fact that the nationalistic, socialistic mineral resource policies that the Venezuelan government has brought in are a threat to Canada's massive mining industry throughout the hemisphere. And there's tens and tens of billions of dollars of Canadian mining investment in Latin America, and pushes efforts, political efforts that go in a direction of more nationalistic, socialistic policies threaten those resources. And there's in Haiti also the coup was partly in 2004 was partly inspired by Canadian Guild and Active Wear that wanted the sweatshop labor. And the Aristide government had doubled the minimum wage. I mean, he was asking companies to pay a full, I think it was $2.50 a day, and they didn't want to. They didn't want to have to pay such an outrageous wage to Haitian sweatshop workers. So that's part of the what went into driving policy in Haiti. But there's no doubt that Canadian corporate interests have. They control the discussion on Canadian foreign policy to a large extent. They're the ones who fund all of the main foreign policy think tanks, from the Canadian Council on Africa, the Canadian Council of Americas, Montreal Conseil Moral International. And so their perspective of international affairs is really a front and center in the discussion.
Yes. It's funny because, Canada – it's always lecturing other countries, including Haiti and Venezuela and other countries, how to behave and what they're doing wrong, and they should be put in front of a court. And meanwhile, look at our own behavior in Venezuela, interfering in an election where Maduro won. There's no question he won, and we are saying, well, this guy, we want him in there, and we're going to use aid as a weapon. You got to take this aid that's tied to political strings, and we're going to use the media against you, and we're going to go right into Haiti and just remove the president, and we're going to fund all sorts of groups that would never be allowed in Canada. We're going to fund media and opposition parties and so on. We're the people lecturing on how people are supposed to behave and run elections. It's just hilarious. Anyway, I think this whole SNC-Lavalin thing has made it easier to see how things really work, both in terms of media and government corporation relationships. You've been hammering away at this at a long time, but I think your position is becoming stronger and more clear. So the work you're doing, it pays off, and you're being shown to be right on so many of these things. So Eve, thanks so much for being with us on this important program today. And again, people can find you at eveengler.com. Is that right? It's eveengler.com?
EveEngler.com. And I just invite listeners to, if you have the ability, to make sure to make a donation, because there are very few media outlets that are willing to talk about Canadian foreign policy from a critical perspective.
Well, thanks very much, Eve. We'll keep an eye out for your next articles.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that was Eve Engler. And I thank him for his fundraising pitch there for us. Yes. It's an important time for us because last month the Ontario government announced they were changing the way student fees were collected. So a large portion of CFMU's funding can disappear. We don't know how much. I don't know, 5%, 50%. We get all sorts of guesses, but it's a very important time to be funding us to keep programming like this going. So you can call in a donation at 905-528-9888. And you can do that during business hours all week. It's 905-528-9888. And Doug can take your call. And of course, you know, if you give $30, you can get a Friends of CFMU card, which you can use at all sorts of local businesses, and like the House of Java and Revolution Records and The Ship. And I've actually used it at some of the local businesses because I got one for doing the fundraiser. This ain't Hollywood. You know, Luke could tell you all about that. You can use this card to get discounts. And so you want to do that. You can donate $30 and get that card. And if you do $45, you can get the card and a CFMU mug. $60 brings you one of the most anticipated prizes. It's the Friends of CFMU card and the T-shirt. And we have new designs in the last few years. So if you have an older one, you probably want to get a newer one. You want to get this one. So you can do that. And of course, if you do $75, you get everything. You get the Friends of CFMU card, you get the T-shirts and the mug. So you can do it that way. And of course, you can, what most people seem to be doing these days is doing it online. You go to cfmu.ca, and you can do this from anywhere. And you don't have to be in Hamilton, but go to cfmu.ca, and there's like a donate thing at the bottom that pops up. And just click on the yellow button. It's I think it's like a PayPal type link. You want to go through there, and if it says, like, mention program, you would mention us, Unusual Sources.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.